Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
John Lewis, no longer in the house. John Lewis, famed for his ungodly beating by state troopers at the Edmund Pettus Bridge during civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s, has moved on after his recent passing at 80 years old. Lewis was a youth when he joined the movement and went on to spend over 30 years as a U.S. representative from Georgia. His life lent luster to a group of politicians who usually garner low marks on public opinion polls. Before this electoral period, as a young man, he led the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC by movement people, before Stokely Carmichael replaced him as chair of the group. Carmichael, who later took the names Kwame Ture to honor African leaders, represented the growing militancy of the Black Freedom Movement. Lewis became the archetype of activist turned politician and also exemplar of the civil rights movement itself. In many ways, he, the son of sharecroppers, exemplified the classic American story of a spectacular rise from modest beginnings. He held fast to the teachings of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for the rest of his life. John Lewis, 1940-2020. March to his ancestors after 80 summers of life. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We should be opening up the political process and letting all of our citizens come in and participate. People dying for the right to vote. Friends of mine, colleagues of mine.
Last Friday, the country lost two giants of the civil rights movement. Representative John Lewis, who you heard there, and Reverend C.T. Vivian, two particularly devastating losses for the country and particularly for Black Americans, many who have been fighting for racial justice and whose communities have also been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. It almost seems unfair to lose these two giants now. We'll talk about Representative Lewis in a few minutes, but we want to start with remembering Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was slightly less in the public eye. He was a Baptist minister and one of Dr. Martin Luther King's closest advisors.
What we were doing was creating a new South, as a part of a whole new concept of our participation in the nation, right? And so that when you see people who are thinking like that for a lifetime, how important it is that you know that it opens doors and that people take you seriously, more seriously than they did before.
Vivian helped lead boycotts, marches, and sit-ins at lunch counters during the civil rights movement. And after that, he helped found numerous civil rights organizations. Vivian died in his home in Atlanta at the age of 95. Joining me now is Greg Carr, associate professor at Howard University and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies. Greg, thanks for joining us.
It's a real pleasure, Tanzina. I really admire your work, and it's great to be in this conversation this morning, today.
Well, let me tell you that, for a hot Monday, that put a great smile on my face. We appreciate you joining us.
Yes.
You know, when we talk about a lot of the civil rights figures, there's so many that come to mind. We don't often hear about Vivian. Tell us how he got his start in the civil rights movement.
And that's truly unfortunate, and that's why I'm particularly glad that you took some time with the takeaway today to talk about both of them in tandem. Cordy Tyndale Vivian was born in Missouri, just outside of Boonville, Missouri, in 1924. And at 6 years old, he moved to Macomb, Illinois. He was raised and trained in integrated schools and went to Western Illinois University. And he is a figure who is an intellectual, really, who became an activist. As you say, he was a minister. And in 1957, he went to the American Baptist Theological Seminary in my hometown of Nashville. And that's where he actually talked to Martin Luther King. He had met Dr. King. He had studied Dr. King a little bit. And then he met Jim Lawson, James Lawson, who is still alive. It's very important because Lawson is really the figure, a minister himself, who brought C.T. Vivian into what became the nonviolent strategies that fed the Nashville movement. I know we're going to talk about John Lewis in a minute, but Lewis was a student by then at the same seminary that that Vivian was at, and they engaged together with others in what we know as the Nashville Student Movement, about a three-month period that really gave birth, along with the work that was being done in North Carolina A&T and Bennett College in North Carolina, to what we call the student phase of the modern civil rights movement. Within a year, C.T. Vivian was at the Freedom Rides. He became a pastor in Chattanooga the year after that, 1962. And by the following year, he was on Martin Luther King's staff. So C.T. Vivian is an anchor person for us to understand that moment in American and world history.
What were C.T. Vivian's main priorities once he entered the movement?
Well, Vivian, interestingly enough, was brought on to Dr. King's staff kind of as a lieutenant for Wyatt T. Walker, who was another one of these great intellectuals out of Virginia, a New York pastor for many years. Vivian was brought in as eventually the director of affiliates. So he was kind of a tip of the spear guy. He was on the steps in St. Augustine, Florida. In fact, he was almost killed there. He was in Selma in 1965. His job was to coordinate the affiliates of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to kind of engage in this direct action protest, what Wyatt T. Walker by 1963 in Birmingham called Operation C, confrontation. And they narrated their villains very carefully. The Bull Connors of Birmingham, the Jim Clarks of Selma. And that's where we see C.T. Vivian confronting Jim Clark on the courthouse steps in Selma. And, of course, he very famously gets struck by that sheriff. And that kind of galvanizes and electrifies the movement in tandem with John Lewis, who, of course, was on the bridge at Independence Bridge down the street in Selma. So his philosophy of nonviolence, his intellect, his moral and courage and conviction kind of congeal in this confrontational style, even in his eloquence in having that confrontation that makes C.T. Vivian part of the tip of the spear of that movement in the 1962 to 65.
Vivian and John Lewis, who we're going to talk about in the next segment, knew each other. And I'm wondering, Greg, can you tell us what their relationship was like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's very interesting. We tend to freeze John Lewis on that bridge and freeze C.T. Vivian on those steps. But, you know, they both, 1965, that important year where we see the passage of the Voting Rights Act, after 1965, they become kind of these iconic figures in the ongoing struggle for human and civil rights in this country. 1965 was also the year I was born. So in many ways, they became kind of North Stars for those of us who were born in that generation and after, to look to in terms of how to conduct ourselves, in terms of protest and struggle, and how to think about the meaning of being African in America and the evolving American democracy. Vivian, of course, went on. He moved to Chicago in 1966. He started the Urban Training Center there to work on getting young people, advancing the lives of young people. He was an architect of Upward Bound, which we know is a very important program. But in short, he lived the rest of his life, eventually relocating to Atlanta, helping Jesse Jackson run for president in 1984. He lived his rest of his life kind of as a spokesperson for that thrust of continual protest to reconstruct, in some ways, the nature of American democracy. That's why he's so iconic, and that's why it's so important to talk about him and lift his voice in this moment as well.
We've got about a minute left in this segment, but you met him in person. Was there one thing that stood out to you, Greg?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking that, Lydia. C.T. Vivian was a world-class bibliophile. First time I met him in Knoxville, Tennessee, we talked about books. And the gleam in his eye, he kind of reminded me of my father. He kind of looked like my father. And we talked about books. And it's very important to understand that he was one of the great minds of his generation. And he believed in preserving memory and education. And in some ways, that's probably his greatest legacy, education. We must always study to improve ourselves so that we can improve the society we live in.
We're talking about civil rights leaders Reverend C.T. Vivian and Representative John Lewis, who both passed away on Friday.
Before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it was almost impossible for many people in the state of Georgia, in Alabama, in Virginia, in Texas, to register to vote, to participate in the democratic process. It's shameful. This bill is a slap in the face of the Declaration of Independence. It denies gay men and women the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Marriage is a basic human right.
Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
John Lewis was the son of a sharecropper in Alabama who became a hugely important leader in the civil rights movement as a young man, and he later went on to become a congressman representing Georgia's 5th District in the House for more than 30 years. Lewis died in his home city of Alabama from pancreatic cancer at the age of 80. Greg, probably one of the most, I mean, just listening to John Lewis's voice there, you know, you can't help but feel that voice. And I think one of the most interesting, among many of the interesting things about John Lewis, was how his fight for equality spanned so many issues. We heard him at the top talking about LGBTQ marriage rights. Is that something that was unique to John Lewis in the way that he framed equality?
Yes, I actually think it was not only unique to Congressman Lewis in the public imagination in this country, but it was also representative, in fact, of a broad swath of African people in this country when it comes to the principled defense of our common humanity. John Lewis, all of his colleagues, Stokely Carmichael, so many others who might disagree with him sometimes ideologically, would say something that I hear often from the SNCC veterans who are still with us. John had the courage of his convictions, they would say. Congressman Lewis was consistent, if nothing else, in his faith and belief in his religion and in the possibilities of the American experiment. So it would, of course, come as no surprise to any of them that he would defend everyone's right not to be in harm's way.
And also, John Lewis decided to run for Congress. I mean, ultimately trying to, as some folks would describe it, making change from within the same federal government that had been oppressing black Americans. Why did he decide to make that move?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Tanzina. I think that is a lesser known side of John Lewis, I think. And some of his colleagues would say, you know, John was a gentleman. He had the courage of his convictions. And John was also he had the possibility of being bare knuckled in his political brawls. The congressional election of 1986 between John Lewis and his friend, his brother, really, Julian Bond, is one of the most controversial elections in the history of black American electoral politics. John Lewis had actually approached Julian Bond when that district kind of opened up in the wake of the Voting Rights Act to run for that position himself. And in between that candidacy, because Julian Bond decided he wouldn't run, Andrew Young ran, became the first African American since Reconstruction to be elected out of Georgia. And then when John Lewis ran, Julian Bond actually declared before. So what you saw was really, in some ways, the class divides in black communities. Julian Bond won the majority of black votes in that election. John Lewis won the majority of white votes in that district and was sent to Congress. And there were charges that Lewis kind of played up his all shucks, plain spoken kind of persona. He called himself a workhorse in contrast to Julian Bond, who he called a show horse. And so even with all his years in Congress and his courage of conviction stances, what we see at that moment is John Lewis becomes in many ways more of the public face of the civil rights movement and the so-called conscience of the Congress than a Julian Bond type or a C.T. Vivian type, which may have been perhaps even, frankly, more unsettling to the American body politic in terms of representing what that movement meant and means.
And Greg, I'm wondering, I've been thinking a lot about him being called the conscience of Congress, and I'm wondering whether or not that was a burden to Representative Lewis.
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, why would any black person or black people or any non-white person in this country have to be called upon to be the conscience of a country when we all have a conscience? So when John Lewis, who said he regretted not standing with Barbara Lee, for example, in condemning the Iraq war and voting against authorization for Bush to go into the war. For John Lewis, who sat on the floor of the United States Congress, joined by Nancy Pelosi and some of the youngsters who had come in, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and others, to say we must pass gun violence legislation. Why would it be on John Lewis or anyone else, for example, to have to set out that marker when there are 400 plus members of the federal legislature? It's an incredible burden, and it's a testament to John Lewis's strength that he was able to not only hold up under that burden, but to continue to carry that responsibility, which I suppose, you know, accrues to the benefit of us all.
There, do we know anything about his reaction to two things, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and the killing of George Floyd? To imagine that John Lewis had spent his entire life fighting for these issues to leave us at a moment where we are at such, where there's such an uprising and such a battle for some of the basic protections that black and white Americans, largely black Americans, I should say, have still not been offered. What do we think? We got about 2 minutes left in the segment, Greg. Do we know what his reaction was to these two issues right now?
Oh, absolutely, Tanzina. He spoke until the end. In terms of voting rights, of course, he suffered there in that bridge in 1965. His very good friend Jim Clyburn has said that there must be a restoration of the Voting Rights Act, and he has suggested it be renamed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So we know that he spoke out in favor of restoring the Civil Rights Act. He shed blood. And as far as the young people are concerned, you know, John Lewis was 21 years old when they pulled him off that bus in Anniston, Alabama, and tried to kill him with the Freedom Rides. He stood in the Black Lives Matter painting there on 16th Street alongside the mayor of D.C. and said, I stand with Black Lives Matter. And more importantly, he stood with the organizers of Black Lives Matter. So John Lewis, right until the day that he made transition, was a very vocal supporter of the youth energy, the intergenerational, multiracial contingent that is engaged in this general strike against the American social order. John Lewis let us know what he thought until the very end, and he stood on the side of right in those cases.
Greg Carr, wonderful talking to you. Greg Carr is an associate professor at Howard University and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Greg.
It's a pleasure, Tanzina, and please continue the good work. I'll be listening to The Takeaway.
The U.S. isn't the only country reckoning with racism right now. In Lebanon, at the prestigious American University of Beirut, African students are speaking up about discrimination. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
Shafar Hamid from Tanzania tells me that, as a black woman and a practicing Muslim, she thought she'd feel more welcome in the Middle East.
I thought it would be a good alternative for me not to go to the United States and go somewhere where people, you know, kind of understand the experience of being, you know, racially profiled.
Arriving at the university, she went to her dorm room.
Everything was fine. I met my roommate. And then it all started.
Hama says her roommate seemed surprised to share with a black person and tried to set rules about what Hama could or couldn't do. In class, some students wouldn't sit beside her. The university told her she was being too sensitive, and the problems were much worse off campus. When Hama had to go to a hospital, a Lebanese patient refused to share a room with her, and on the street, she says, she was sometimes treated like a prostitute.
There's scary moments, you know, when someone tries to touch you or someone like in the street, like is adamant following you, trying to offer you money for sex. And you're like, oh, my goodness, should I start running? You know,
Hamid had always been good at exams, but now she felt so tested in her daily life that she couldn't face them. She went to see a counselor on campus who asked her what was wrong.
And I said the words, I was like, for the first time in my life, I have experienced racism, and I know what it is. And I said it out loud, and I knew that was the problem. And I just broke down crying.
We reached Hamid at her home in Tanzania, where she says she dreads going back after the summer break. A recent graduate, Claudette Igudaneza from Rwanda, collected during her degree and published online in June the testimonies of 21 other African students.
What happens to many African students on campus is like, them failing to be part of the community, them being discriminated by their fellow students.
Dr. Talal Nizamuddin, the Dean of Student Affairs, tells NPR that the university has a zero-tolerance policy on racism and is always working to improve.
The key is that you ensure equity, you ensure justice, you ensure fair treatment on an institutional level, and I honestly believe AUB does that.
But he says it's a battle in Lebanon overall. We asked a Lebanese student and friend of Hamis, Batul Nuruddin, why this is. She believes the racism in Lebanon is connected to class bias.
Lebanon identity is still like a struggle between the Lebanese themselves.
She explains, Lebanon is divided. There are Christians, Shiites, Sunnis, Druze, and they all look down on each other. And at the bottom is Lebanon's large migrant workforce. Mostly from Ethiopia, they work as housemaids or in other jobs that Nuruddin says the Lebanese see as being beneath them.
And then someone else with this particular skin colour, with a black skin colour, came to take this job. So they were perceived as inferior.
University student Igidaneza from Rwanda says she drove this point home by wearing a maid's uniform to some of her lectures.
Some people respect us, but then when they go back to their homes, they mistreat their domestic workers. It doesn't make sense.
She says she's going to get a master's in Britain, and then when she graduates, maybe return to Lebanon to try to fight the discrimination that people of colour face there. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
Black woman who's lived in Elmont with her family for the past 4 years. She says she was routinely called racial slurs while using a path she took to and from work as a personal support worker. Jacob Green was one of the organizers of the march.
I run a food truck in Elmont. It's in a big parking lot. It's near like a residential area, so I have there's a house behind me, and there's this community path. It is on private property, but you know, the whole town has been using this path for, you know, I've heard people in their 60s saying that they've used this path when they were kids. But for some reason, Denise would use this path, and I witnessed this firsthand because I, you know, I run my business behind this path here, and these neighbors would shout out racial slurs to Denise and bully and threaten her to the point where they actually followed Denise one day in their car and started shouting at her and threatening her and harassing her. You know, I wasn't going to stand for this, especially, you know, behind my own business. And so this was a way for not just me, but all of Elmont to stand with Denise.
Jacob Green, one of the organizers of Come Walk with Denise, which had more than 500 people in attendance on Saturday. This afternoon, we reached Brianna Lovick-Well. She is Denise's 18-year-old daughter, and she spoke at that march. Hi, Brianna.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, tell me when you first realized that level of harassment was happening to your mom.
So most of it started happening while I was at university and not living at home, so I could only hear most of the accounts secondhand, not firsthand, as they began in fall, and that's when I was living in Ottawa to go to school. But she's personally told me when I would come home from school to stay the weekend what's been going on.
What does that do to you when your mom starts talking about those kinds of things happening to her?
It's obviously very hard because my mom is a very strong, hardworking woman, and usually things like that don't get to her because they've been happening to us for so long, living in small towns that are predominantly white. And she used to just brush it off when it would be small things, but after it started becoming a routine, it obviously started affecting her more. So I was just trying to do everything I could to radiate positivity in our household and make sure that she was okay, and getting friends to drive her to work to make her feel more safe.
When you say noticing it was affecting her more, what did you see happen with your mom?
There was just a lot of anxiety and fear around the situation, especially after articles in the Ottawa Citizen and our townspaper were written. Because as the word was put out, more negative comments were flooding in, and she obviously saw the positive ones, but it's sometimes hard to be able to just look at the positive when there's so much negative. So it just became like an even bigger fear that, oh, now if the word's out, something else will happen, if that makes sense.
But when you say negative, I mean, in terms of negative reaction when people find out this is going on, like that she shouldn't be complaining about it, or that she shouldn't be speaking out about it, or what were they...
More than a lot of people just didn't believe it in the first place. They'd say, I've lived in this town for so long, that doesn't exist, that doesn't happen here, but the people that would say that obviously aren't people of color, so they wouldn't have ever had to experience it in the first place, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of us just tirelessly repeating ourselves, saying that this is happening and racism is alive here, and then there's certain few just disputing it.
Before your mom's situation, I mean, were you the sort to speak out about it too? I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you would have experienced the racism as well.
Yes, yes. While living in Almont, I went to school in the town over, and so I didn't. For me, I worked here as well, so when I'd be walking home from work late at night, cars would drive past me and call me the N-word and just scream things at me, and so I wouldn't know what to do, so I'd just keep my head down and walk a little faster, and a lot of kids here just say racial slurs like it's nothing, so not only is it, like, personally happened to me, but I just would see it around a lot.
I just want to remind people who are just tuning in that LeBron is 18 years old, in case you're trying to place the age range that we're talking about. This is not something that happened a long time ago. We're talking about the present day. And I'm wondering, therefore, that idea of keeping your head down, not bringing it up, not mentioning it, when somebody then comes forward and says, I know, we should do a big march, what was the initial reaction?
I was honestly surprised because... Jacob came out with the idea, the owner of the food truck, to do the march very shortly after the article was published. So I wasn't expecting a really big turnout or a lot of people to even be there. So when we walked there and we saw the parking lot filled with people, we were just kind of in shock at the amount of, like, citizens in Almont that would come out to support us, if that makes sense.
Was there a part of you, I mean, before you saw the 500, was there a part of you that did, or that your mom that didn't want the march, that were worried about what the response was going to be?
I feel like regardless of what it was, whether it was a Facebook post, a march, or someone talking to us, there's always that initial fear, like, someone's going to say something wrong. Like, whenever I'd receive messages on Facebook after we posted the story, I'd be hesitant to open them, wondering if it's going to be something negative or positive. So regardless of the situation, there will always be a little bit of fear of what the response will be.
So tell me, you get there, 500 people in the parking lot, supportive people, I want to add, it is showing up for the march. What did that mean to you? What did it mean to your mom?
It meant a lot, considering how, in a town of 5,000 and how short notice it was, that many people came out. We honestly weren't expecting it at all. My mom was asked to dress the crowd, and she couldn't even. I feel like we were both overwhelmed with emotion. And it was a lot of people that I saw that I recognized as well. And the fact that it wasn't only people we knew, but strangers out there to support us, it obviously meant a lot considering everything that was going on.
You say that she couldn't speak at that point. Could you? I mean, could you? Was it hard to get up there?
I wasn't expecting it. When we got there, we were asked by one of the organizers, Jeff, to address the crowd. He initially asked my mom, but she said she'd rather I do it for her. So I just stood there with her, and I spoke on our family's behalf. And obviously, I was a bit nervous having not done something like that before. But once I felt the comfort in the area and just looking around and seeing all the people there to support us, not do anything else, it was very easy for me to just kind of let the words come out of it. Yeah.
Do you feel like, I mean, nobody should say that a 500-person march is insignificant in any way.
Yeah.
Or that isn't action of a sort being taken. Now, what do you do with that? How do you move forward? Because obviously that doesn't put an end to racism in Almont or beyond. And I'm wondering what you would like to see happen, do, action taken.
From now on, I just kind of hope that the march was just the beginning of a change, because obviously if there's 500 people on such short notice in one day there to support us, I just have faith that there will be even more people within the community in future that will not just leave this as a march. They'll just the message will have been brought to light, and they'll address racism in the town and correct people if they say something inappropriate. And I'm just hoping that it's just positivity from here and more recognizing that racism is here, but doing our best to fight it, if that makes sense.
And have the comments been coming in since the march? Is there anything that indicates things are changing? I know it's not exactly the most scientific way of judging that, that thoughts or ideas have shifted, but I mean, is there anything, anything that's coming in so far that gives you that hope?
Since the publishing of the article in our town's paper, the Ottawa Citizen and the March, I've been getting a lot of private messages, my mom as well, on Facebook, of people that I don't even know offering to drive and walk my mom to work and saying that they support us. And a lot of people have been sharing the story, so I feel in this, there are a lot of people out there willing to help, and that the march has done a lot to get a lot of people involved from now on, and that hopefully our positive actions and caringness will spread throughout the town.
Brianna, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All the best to your mom, too.
From Imprisoned Nation.
Thousands of people in the last few months have been released early from jails and prisons because of the coronavirus. But it's also part of a much bigger movement, rethinking incarceration. Sarah Gonzalez with our Planet Money podcast takes us to Oklahoma.
Alexis Nicholson is 25. She's always been close to her dad.
I've always been a daddy's girl, you know what I mean? So I've always been close to him, even though he's always been far away, I guess you could say.
Her dad was arrested when she was 8 years old. According to transcripts, police went into her dad's house after his home burglary alarm had gone off. And inside the house, police found some money in a shoebox, along with a gun and 635 grams of crack cocaine, which is a little over a pound, enough to be considered trafficking.
I do remember when I got told, my grandma picked me up from school, and she was just like, "They got your dad?" So I asked her, I said, who has them? She said, the police do.
Her dad had been caught with drugs twice before. And in Oklahoma, two drug convictions plus a trafficking conviction carried one sentence only, the rest of your life. The jury gave her dad life in prison, which was mandatory, plus another 1,650 years after.
Okay, you're Reginald A. Nicholson, Jr.?
Yes, sir.
But this year, after 17 years behind bars, Reggie Nicholson got the chance to ask if he could one day be released from prison, even though he was told that would never be possible. Here he is, about to ask.
You recognize these folks?
Yes, sir. That's my mom, that's my son, and that's my daughter. Oh, that's my dad also.
This was in February. It's Reggie Nicholson's parole hearing.
A year ago, I didn't have a chance at parole.
The whole thing lasts less than 6 minutes.
All right. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
And that's it. Now the board votes.
Kelly Doyle.
Yes.
Adam Luck.
Yes.
Alan McCall.
Yes, ma'am. CS.
Robert Gilliland.
Yes, CS.
Paroles granted to the CS case.
The board just said he can get out now. 17 years into his life plus 1,650-year sentence. And Reggie Nicholson did not get before this board because his case stood out. It didn't stand out. He got here because lawmakers said, maybe we went too far. In 2018, Oklahoma became the number one incarcerator in the country. They're still number one for women.
That's whack.
Chris Steele was in the Oklahoma House of Representatives when Reggie Nicholson was sentenced.
That is the saddest thing I've ever heard.
He's Republican, and every year Steele says he and his fellow Republicans voted to put more people in prison for more offenses and for longer periods of time.
And we gave very little thought to the actual cost.
In 2008, corrections had become Oklahoma's fastest-growing expenditure after Medicaid. And at first, Chris Steele was like, that's totally fine if it's making us safer. But it wasn't. And for him, this went against a core conservative principle.
I would even go as far as to say that it's impossible to identify oneself as a fiscal conservative and continue to be okay with wasting money on an inefficient system.
Chris Steele is now with a group called Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform. They got voters to reduce some of the penalties for drug possession. And other states have been doing similar things too. New Jersey, Alaska, Alabama, they've cut their prison populations by about 35%, according to the Sentencing Project. but this group also helped get the governor to shorten sentences, like Reggie Nicholson's. His life plus 1,650-year sentence was commuted to 20 years. That's why he got the parole hearing. He is still in prison, though. There's a backlog. But about 1,000 others have already been released early.
We're out of here.
Like Jacquez Nickelberry.
Man, it feels good to be out. It was...
He got 20 years for marijuana possession, but the governor shortened his sentence to 5 years, which he's already done. What are you doing right now?
Posting on Facebook that I'm free. Don't you got to put www at the beginning? You don't? Hey, I forgot. I don't know how to work this.
Shortening prison sentences has saved the state about $12 million so far. But it only took Oklahoma from the number one incarcerator to the number three. Sarah Gonzalez, NPR News.
On May 4th, 1961, James Farmer leads 13 people, black and white, onto buses in Washington, D.C., bound for New Orleans. Ten days later, the bus enters Alabama, home to the largest KKK organization in America.
There's been a great deal of attention on the spike of COVID cases in states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California. But other states are struggling with it profoundly, too, like Louisiana and Alabama. Alabama doctors and nurses are seeing record numbers of hospitalizations associated with COVID, more than 9,000 as of today. The state has reported almost 1,400 deaths since the pandemic began, and there are nearly 75,000 cases. Stephanie Tsai has a report tonight on how the virus has hit especially hard in a county in the central part of the state, and how huge health disparities among black residents are leading to even worse outcomes.
A 90-degree July afternoon deep in Lowndes County, Alabama, is nothing like a walk around heaven. But the mourners came anyway to pay their respects to a pillar of the community, dead at the age of 50 from COVID-19.
We're here for the homegoing service of Pamela Sue Rush, New Mount Lily Baptist Church, Hainesville, Alabama.
And I wouldn't get no heat and stuff in the house. My daughter cried every morning to say it's cold in the house.
Pamela Rush was first featured on the PBS NewsHour in 2018 in a report on extreme poverty, showing the squalid conditions she was living in, no sewage system, and a trailer home she worried was making her and her children sick.
I need to, you know, get out of this house because the mold and stuff in there is bad on your hair.
Animals were getting in, she lamented, showing the trap cages.
So I got diabetes, and I don't need to get bite by no animal.
She couldn't have known then that a much bigger risk lay ahead. The tragedy of Pamela Rush's life and death has deep roots. Her neighborhood was built on former slave quarters, and the abject poverty she experienced can be traced back to the legacy of slavery in the Southern Black Belt, so named for the fertile soil that lay the foundation for cotton plantations.
I was devastated.
Catherine Flowers is a cousin of Rush's and an environmental justice activist who enlisted Rush in her advocacy work.
Hi, my name is Pamela Rush. I'm from Lowndes County, Alabama, and I live in a mobile home with my two kids.
In June of 2018, Rush and others testified before a congressional committee as part of the Revived Poor People's Campaign.
They charged me over $114,000 on a mobile home. They're falling apart.
I was devastated because we did not get a chance to get her out of that trap that she was in and to let her benefit from the work that she had been doing all this time to move her family from the home that she was staying in.
Pamela Rush's is only one of the lives claimed by the pandemic in Lowndes County. Terrell Means is the county coroner.
My average calls a week will be one or two. Before the COVID and everything, but after COVID came, it started picking up five to seven a week.
So far, 537 cases and 26 deaths from COVID-19 have been documented in this sparsely populated place of less than 10,000 residents. The virus has infected 1 in 17 people there, the highest infection rate in Alabama and one of the highest in the country. Like Rush, many people here have diabetes, which experts say puts them at higher risk of death from COVID-19.
Anyone in your family with a history of diabetes?
Yes.
Okay. Has anyone ever said whether you might be diabetic?
No.
Dr. George Thomas, the only doctor in the county, suspects 60-year-old Elvis Harrison has it.
We can let you know before you leave if you do have diabetes.
Harrison takes the test and gets results on the spot.
You are diabetic. Okay, and we do need to start you on some medicine.
So I was kind of surprised that I did have it because I got rid of most of the cookies and I got rid of the candy. I guess I just had to stick with the fruit.
Dr. Scott Harris is the state's top health officer.
Alabama is not the healthiest state to begin with, and our African-American population disproportionately suffers from a number of chronic health problems. And when they have a serious systemic infection, then it just makes it that much more difficult for them.
Throughout the nation, the pandemic has had an outsized impact on African-Americans. But in Lowndes County, history may help explain why.
This is a map that shows a pictorial representation of the 1860 Alabama census.
African-Americans are represented in blue and whites in red.
So all of these blue segments here represent enslaved people.
Dr. Harris says if you look today at where the most people in Alabama have chronic health conditions, it matches where the most slaves lived during the 1860 census.
The legacy of these enslaved people in Alabama's Black Belt is still felt today in the health disparity that we have. The African American population in Alabama make up more than a third of COVID-19 cases, and they make up over 45%, approaching half of all deaths.
Founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson, says lingering trauma also affects health.
Lowndes County saw lots of black people lynched, pulled out of their homes, beaten, tortured, drowned, hanged. And that creates trauma. It creates an emotional injury, a psychological injury. And then you combine that with a lack of employment and then most critically a lack of health care, and you make an already vulnerable population more vulnerable when it comes to COVID.
There's no hospital in Lowndes County today.
All the way from Selma Town.
And there wasn't one in 1965 when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the late John Lewis, and more than 3,000 supporters passed through on their way to Montgomery. But the gains of the civil rights movement have not reversed the downward trajectory in Lowndes County.
We have failed to acknowledge the role of injustice, inequality, and bigotry in creating many of the conditions that continue to make us sick.
But there are, finally, signs that times are changing. Since 1940, a Confederate monument had stood in the Hayneville Town Square in Lowndes County. It bore the names of Confederate soldiers whose families owned slaves, among them Pamela Rush's ancestors. In the wake of the protests against the killing of George Floyd, the monument came down in June.
To be quite honest, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. That history that that monument represented was very, very strong and represented the terror that was inflicted upon our family.
Terror perpetuated by systemic racism that put Catherine Flowers' cousin, Pamela, at great risk when COVID-19 came to Lowndes County.
And it's hard. I couldn't buy my children a stuff for what they need.
That soft-spoken voice in front of members of Congress somehow echoes louder in her passing.
I have to make sure that in Pamela's memory and for her children's future that we dismantle these structures that kept her trapped.
America's reckoning with racism will come too late for Pamela Rush, but perhaps it will arrive in time for Bianca and Jeremiah, left too soon without a mother. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Yeah, hold up, shorty. Hold up, let me answer this. Chill. Chill. All right. Yo, hello?
When you download an app, whether it's a game, a run tracker, or even the weather, you might get a prompt asking you to let the app access your location. It's probably not news to you that if you say yes, the advertising industry then collects that location data from you, packages it up, and sells it. But you might not know that they're not just selling your data to marketers and other people who want you to buy stuff. People in the advertising industry are also selling it to the government. Our reporter Byron Tao has been looking into this, and he joins us now to explain. Byron, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you reported on a team of researchers in Mississippi. They used some of this location data to track a group of people in Russia. Where all did they trace them?
So this was part of an open source intelligence project paid for by the U.S. military. And these academic researchers were looking at drone test sites and other military facilities across Eastern Europe, including in Russia. And as part of this experiment, they were looking at where people present at these drone test sites or military bases were going. Were they traveling back to Moscow? Were they meeting with members of the Russian presidential administration or foreign officials? Simply, where were they going? And by tracing their cell phone movements, they were able to find out a lot. One person that they were tracking went on vacation to Cuba. Another person went to this sort of key geopolitical strategic region in Azerbaijan. Others went to other secure Russian military districts. You know, what we found was that it was pretty easy and pretty extraordinary to get a level of detail about the movement of these purportedly Russian military officials and or military civilians with access to military facilities and track them around the world.
So like you said, these guys were researchers. They were academics. They were not intelligence analysts. So what were they doing with this data?
So this data comes from a commercial vendor, a company called Babel Street, which is publicly in the business of monitoring social media. They offer a lot of services to local police departments and governments at all levels to monitor unfolding situations. But they also sell this little add-on called LocateX, which basically is a feed of data drawn from the advertising industry on millions, if not hundreds of millions, of cell phones. And these researchers partnered with Babel Street. They got some funding from the U.S. Army, and that's how they were able to pull this kind of data and do this kind of analysis.
And what exactly were they setting out to prove?
Well, they were trying to demonstrate to the Army the power and the usage of open source intelligence. So the kind of data that you can buy on the commercial market, stuff like cell phone data, but there's also all sorts of other data out there. So social media data, data from web forums, photos that people upload to social media sites, all of that has real legitimate intelligence value if you know where to look and what questions to ask. And so this project was part of an effort to show the military just how powerful this kind of data could be.
I think consumers have kind of a low-level understanding that whatever they do on their phones might be, you know, data is being collected about them, and they kind of see it as something that's probably just annoying. It's a way for, you know, advertisers and marketers to target us with hyper-specific advertising. How common is this other, more governmental use?
Well, we don't know the extent of it, but it does seem like from my reporting that this kind of acquisition of commercial data is of increasing interest to governments around the world, not just the American government, but others. And it raises real privacy considerations, right? Because when you consent to an app tracking you, you may have some understanding that marketers are looking at this data, but most consumers don't understand that the flow of data in this world, in this ecosystem, means that pretty much anyone can get it, from foreign intelligence services to their domestic political opponents to, you know, major intelligence agencies or law enforcement agencies. And so this data is all out there. You know, in some cases, it's quote-unquote anonymous. It doesn't link to anyone's specific name. But your patterns in the world tell people a lot about you. And analysts can use movement data, for example, to figure out where a phone is at night. And that is a strong clue to where that person lives and can be cross-checked against property records. So all this raises a lot of interesting and unresolved privacy questions about just how much notice consumers have about what's happening to their data.
Is this legal?
That's a good question. Courts really haven't grappled with these questions. In general, the government has taken the position that if consumers opt into tracking, by and large, the purchase of that kind of data is lawful. But we're really in a new frontier here, because courts really haven't had to consider exactly what it means to be carrying around a tracking device, a microphone, and a camera that could be turned on by adversaries or hackers or even foreign governments all the time. And so the privacy impacts of this are just beginning to be examined by lawyers, courts, privacy advocates, and governments.
What have these companies said about your reporting, about these partnerships with law enforcement?
Generally speaking, most of these companies, especially the ones that are selling cell phone data, are trying to operate below the radar. By and large, they have refused to discuss their products with me. In fact, Babel Street has a confidentiality clause in its standard license agreement that prevents the user from even disclosing the existence of their location data product. And so a lot of this is being done secretly, even as these companies are telling the government, don't worry, this is 100%, you know, consumer opt-in data. It's 100% publicly available. No issues here with privacy. And so that's a really interesting paradox that I found as I've gone about reporting this.
All right. Our reporter, Byron Tao, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time, and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
And with shootings on the rise in New York City, but police credibility on the decline, the city started experimenting this weekend with new ways for the NYPD and community anti-violence groups to work together on prevention. With us now, one of the linchpins of that effort with cred in many directions, City Council Member Robert Cornegy of Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. We'll also talk about other issues, depending on how much time we have, including the heat, the pandemic, and the defacing of the Black Lives Matter mural in his district that he helped push to get created. Councilman, we really appreciate you making some time for us today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you for having me.
First, how did the weekend go? Did the wave of shootings begin to subside?
No, sir, it did not. And concentrated centrally on central Brooklyn, there's still a consistent uptick. We've had shootings. We had two murders. So it's very concerning, obviously. There are good quality folks who really don't appreciate this uptick in crime and are looking for some resolution immediately.
Can you explain the new partnership, if that's the right word, what the mayor called the Central Brooklyn Violence Prevention Effort, and with similar things in other neighborhoods, between the city and community nonviolence groups, and how it went into action this weekend?
Absolutely. So this came out of a call that we were all on when the first shootings took place. So we understand that during the summer months, and in particular now because of the pandemic and people having been locked away in their homes and are just getting out, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of mental health treatment needs to take place, but there's no excuses. But I am happy to partner with the mayor. You know, he had an all-out program where when they see an uptick in violence, in particular gun violence, they send out resources, police resources. So they add police to those areas to make sure that they can make them safe. We decided that we wanted to meet them where they were. And when they go all out, we literally go all out as well with services. I want to first say, though, that Brian, violence, in my opinion, and I've been screaming this for the last three decades, is a public health issue. And until we decide and agree that it's a public health issue and put the resources that are necessary on a consistent basis, we're going to keep having these upticks and lulls and upticks and lulls. We need to concentrate our efforts and our resources around getting rid of violence in particular. This country's affection and love for violence is well noted statistically in our entertainment, in our music, in everything about this country. So while gun violence is the most sensationalized, actually there's an even higher increase in domestic violence based on the pandemic and based on people being in close quarters for long periods of time. So violence is now and has always been in this country a public health issue, and until we decide to view it in that manner and allocate the appropriate resources, I think we'll still be having this back and forth conversation and good times and bad times. And I know that we can do better in terms of addressing violence in this country, in particular gun violence.
And listeners, we can take a few phone calls for City Council Member Robert Cornegie of Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. If you're in his district in particular, where the Central Brooklyn anti-violence effort has gotten going, and you want to say anything or ask him a question, feel free, or anyone else with anything relevant, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Councilman, I want to play you a clip of Police Commissioner Dermot Shea at a news conference on Friday, and then ask you a question about it. Here's the commissioner.
When we have situations, I heard many of them yesterday, where we have individuals involved in current violence throughout this city, and then when you look at their rap sheet, they have 3, 4, 5 prior gun arrests. You just have to stop and shake your head and say, what is going on? There's got to be a different way to do this in terms of getting guns off the street, but doing it in a way that builds trust with the community and also getting people prosecuted.
Commissioner Dermot Shea on Friday. Councilman, I think he was getting at a few things in that clip. One of them is he says he knows who's committing the gun violence. When you look at their rap sheet, they have 3, 4, 5 prior gun arrests. And I think the commissioner is frustrated with the number of people being let out of Rikers because of pandemic coronavirus prevention and with a bail reform, and so are you and he at odds in any other way you want to react to that clip?
Well, what I'd like to say is the bail reform that we fought for was to make sure that we didn't continue in this city and in our jail system to criminalize the poor. So there are many cases where people had low-level offenses, but because they were unable to meet even the minimum amount of bail, they were stuck on Rikers Island or in jails. That was the design of bail reform, to actually reduce the number of people who were in jails, in the jails, in the five boroughs and on Rikers Island, based on small offenses. So I don't know how we're correlating that to gun charges and to assaults. That's not who that bail reform is for. When we think about Khalif Browder, who spent almost 3 years on Rikers Island without even being charged simply because his family could not afford the minimum amount of bail, it's those individuals that we wanted to seek to make sure that we didn't criminalize poverty. So you should have your day in court. You should have a speedy trial, which is also something that is a problem in our criminal justice system. So I disagree with Commissioner Shea if the inference was that bail reform is responsible for this uptick in crime. You know, the criminal, first of all, there's a lot of blame to go around. And while depraved individuals are responsible for pulling the trigger, we as a society have loaded the bullets into the gun by having a broken criminal justice system, by having a criminal justice system that would seek to criminalize being poor. That's a ridiculous construct. So I disagree if that was the inference in that particular quote. I know that there's an underlying idea And I think it only incites people more. The bail reform was designed to make sure that if you could not afford bail for a minimal offense, that you would be able to have your day in court, but be able to return home to your family.
And the disbanding of the so-called anti-crime unit in response to the protests. As you know, the NYPD did recently disband that plainclothes unit, which was seen as using tactics that were too aggressive too often. Now some people are saying reassigning those officers to the detective squad is one reason for the spike in shootings in the last month, because the anti-crime unit worked proactively to get guns off the street, while the detectives are reactive, investigating shootings after they occur. How much do you agree or disagree with that assertion?
I think disbanding that may have been misguided. There should have been a step-down process, not a total disbanding of that unit, especially since we understand that some of that work, in addition to the work of our crisis management, had resulted in us being the safest big city in the country. So listen, 36,000 officers compared to 8 million citizens. There's no way that policing can be effective unless it's between the community and the police department. Those ratios just don't bear out to make us the safest city. So my community in particular never asked to abolish the police. We asked for policing to take place in our communities that didn't violate our civil and human rights. That's a different narrative. So we have an opportunity to make change. I think that it's important to look back and where we've errored. If it's in disbanding that unit, then we need to go back and look at it and revisit it. And I just want to say about this whole defund, because I know we're going to get there, Brian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the budget negotiation team, which meant I sat daily, 6 hours a day in some instances, pouring through the budget in order to try to make up for a $9 billion budget deficit due to COVID spending. So every agency, including the NYPD, had to tighten their belts. So when we went after the $1 billion in budget, it wasn't about penalizing the police department. It was about everybody doing their fair share to make sure that we could match a budget with that big a hole in it. So we were doing 15% across the board cuts to everything. There was 47% cuts to youth services. How could that be and no cuts to NYPD? So I just want to be clear that this idea that those cuts were designed to penalize the department, that wasn't really the budget negotiation team's goal. It was to make sure that every agency in this city tightened its belts and that one particular demographic didn't bear the entire brunt of the budget. When the mayor first proposed the budget, in his budget proposal, there was zero cuts to NYPD and 47% cuts to programs like Summer Youth Employment Program. And so when we did our budget response, it included the $1 billion that advocates asked for, but not based on penalizing them, based on the fact that everybody had to tighten their belts in this particular economy. As a good fiscal steward, which I deem myself and my colleagues to be, especially on a budget negotiation team, that mm-hmm. was quintessential in getting us to a place where we could balance out a budget of $9 billion deficit. So I think it's important to note that we were already in the process of doing the work of tightening the belts of every single agency, including NYPD.
I hear you. Do you want to do more structural reform, though, like why not, you know, to take a fairly aggressive example, why not recreate the NYPD like they're talking about recreating the Minneapolis Police Department and some others, make every officer reapply for their jobs even under new 21st century rules that council would write and really reinvent?
Listen, we are all trying to re-envision policing in this country, in particular in this city. So I don't think anything's off the table in terms of re-envisioning and reinventing criminal justice in our country. I've been working on criminal justice reform for the last 3 decades. And now there is an appetite based on the demonstrations and protests, based on the coalescing of ethnicities and socioeconomic factors. We've never seen the appetite for change the way we see it now. And so I want to thank those people who have taken to the streets to make sure that their voices are heard and to make sure that this country now has an appetite for change. I think what we've seen with the protests and the demonstrations, those that were legal, is this country's desire to get to a place where everyone is treated equal and there's equity, especially in criminal justice.
What's your reaction to the incident where three NYPD people, including Chief of Department Terrence Monahan, were injured by protesters on the Brooklyn Bridge last week? You know, President Trump is trying to run for re-election in part on this spike in crime in New York City and other cities. He says Democratic Party-run cities are the problem because Democratic politicians in cities won't put the hammer down, is I think his phrase. And he's using that instance on the bridge. It plays on Fox News a lot. How can the movement best retain its credibility? And how do you think that needs to be seen in context, so since so many people are seeing it?
So listen, we have made tremendous strides without the violence. These assaults, there's no scenario that I can think of where you can assault an officer. The peaceful protests that have taken place are what have gotten us to where we are today. And where we are today is having substantive policy and legislation changes. There's a suite of bills that are accountability bills, the chokehold bill, so many bills coming out of the New York City Council and the state legislature and the federal legislature. So that chokehold bill coming out of D.C. And on every level. So I think that we've demonstrated that with the peaceful protests, you can get the attention of lawmakers across the country and get substantive legislation. The assaults and the violence, there's no place for that in this. And like I said, there's no scenario that I can think of where assault on an officer, high ranking or rank and file, is something that we condone. We have gotten to a place where we've gotten budget cuts, never happened before, unprecedented, where we've gotten policy and legislative changes in accountability with the NYPD, unprecedented. And I just want to point out that most of the pieces of legislation that the mayor signed into law a couple of days ago have been languishing. They've been around since before Eric Garner. So mm-hmm. We've been working on this. The country's appetite for it just seems to be coming into bear now. And because of that, because of the peaceful protests, because of the consistency of them, because of the makeup of the demonstrators, we were able to be successful with getting good policy and legislative changes, plus budget changes. You have to stay in that lane. This lane around violence only perpetuates the idea that there is lawlessness. And like you said, our president is currently using that as a platform to incite his supporters, and most of it is really not true. But those examples, there is no scenario that anybody who's been working for criminal justice or police reform would suggest that assaulting officers is a way to get where we've gotten. We got where we are today based on good, peaceful demonstration and protest. And I want to encourage young people who are out there to continue to do that and don't, you know, get caught up in this violence portion where some people are inserting themselves into these demonstrations and protests with the intention of doing harm.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today, the Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
With Montana News, I'm Corin Cades Carney. The Missoula City Attorney's Office announced its pressing charges against a man that detained a Black Lives Matter protester at a rally outside the county courthouse in early June. Nick Mott reports.
48-year-old Mark David Belden faces misdemeanor charge for unlawful restraint and operating as a private security guard without a license. The Missoula County Attorney's Office determined there was a lack of probable cause for a felony hate crime. According to the police report, Belden, who was armed and acting as personal security for some protest organizers, stopped an African-American man dressed in a hoodie, gloves, sunglasses, and face mask at an alley near the courthouse. Belden demanded identification, and the man refused. He turned to leave the situation, and Belden instigated a chase. The man was detained by a group of people until police arrived on the scene. That event sparked a June 14th protest in Missoula, which featured speakers decrying, quote, vigilantism, unquote, and private citizens wielding guns at Black Lives Matter rallies. Another rally is scheduled for Saturday at 12 p.m. while maintaining social distance from cars. Mark David Belden is ordered to appear in court on or before July 31st. His charges carry maximum penalties of a $500 fine and 6 months in jail, and a $1,000 fine and a year in jail, respectively. I'm Nick Ma, Montana Public Radio News.
This is dedicated to who it may concern.
NBC 10 Boston exclusive tonight. A worried mother speaking out after a concerning incident in Newburyport. A man yelled a racial slur at the woman's two sons, and now police are investigating. NBC 10's Eli Rosenberg joins us live from Newburyport now with the details on this. Eli.
Well, Shannon, the mother of these two 14-year-old boys, say they are still very upset about what happened out here Thursday night. A lot of reaction tonight in town as police confirm they are investigating.
The anger is evident. Witnesses saying the man in the car yelling a racial slur just moments before.
This guy came from nowhere and attacked my son using the N-word and...
It was last Thursday evening, and Adama Berry says her twin 14-year-old sons were handing out free donuts on State Street when the man drove by yelling at them.
I cried for 2 days, you know, and my kids are so polite. I wish you can meet them.
State Street was packed that night. Witnesses rushing to comfort the boys.
And I just said, I'm sorry. This is not about you.
Kelly Mount seen here leaning into the car, even confronting the driver.
He just went off on me and like was literally, the anger was scary. Like it was, and that's when I removed myself and I said, you're racism, you, people like you are not welcome here.
Call them. Call the police.
Witnesses say the man circled the block, parking again in that spot, and casually walked by. Video showing after all of it, the man repeating what he said.
Excuse me? What did you call him? What did you call him?
Before driving off.
It's bad. You know, we all one race. You know?
I just don't get it.
I don't get it.
And as you can see right there, this mother's still upset all these days later. As you also saw, a lot of good video there of the man's license plate. Police tell us they know who he is. They've identified him. And right now they're working with the district attorney to determine if what happened out here rises to a hate crime. Live in Newburyport, Eli Rosenberg, NBC 10 Boston.
I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy.
Welcome back to Indiana News Desk. Two men are facing charges after Vox Booker, who was black, accused a group of white men of assaulting him near Lake Monroe over the July 4th weekend. Now, video clips that captured part of the incident show several white people surrounding Booker, who's down on the ground in a wooded area. Another shows a shirtless white man shouting racial slurs at the person recording. The videos went viral, amassing millions of views on Facebook and triggered a series of protests in Bloomington. My colleague Mitch Legan has been closely following this case, and he joins me now from the newsroom with the latest. Hi, Mitch.
Hey, Joe. Yeah, we had quite the shakeup this morning when the prosecutor's office sent out the news release with the charges. We received the 68-page DNR report last night, and I read all of it, so it's been quite a whirlwind. But according to the release, Erica Oliphant, the Monroe County prosecutor, is charging Sean Purdy and Jerry Cox. Purdy's the one in the red shirt in the video, and Cox is the big guy with the tattoos. Purdy's being charged with criminal confinement, battery resulting in moderate bodily injury, and intimidation, all of which are felonies. Cox, on the other hand, is charged with aiding, inducing, or causing criminal confinement, and battery resulting in moderate bodily injury, which are both felonies. He's also facing misdemeanor charges of intimidation and two counts of battery.
So you mentioned that DNR report released yesterday. I haven't had a chance to go through all of it, but your story on it last night said they listed a series of charges Vox could face too, but Oliphant isn't charging him with anything.
Yeah, so the big thing that jumped out to me was the fact that the DNR basically suggested charges all around, including against Vox Booker. It listed six potential crimes that occurred that day, three by Purdy and Cox and three by Booker. When we spoke to Vox last week, he said he was walking through public land and the incident occurred on public land. According to the report, he could have been charged with criminal trespass for going onto the McCord property after he had been told it was private property and asked not to come back. He could have also faced two charges of misdemeanor battery, one against Purdy and the other against Cox. And I should mention here that Purdy's side claims Booker started the incident, getting in the face of Purdy's girlfriend and the property owner, Caroline McCord. Purdy says he stepped in between the two, and Booker punched him three times. They claim Booker was being restrained when the cameras started rolling because they were worried he'd start swinging again.
So was there anything in the report about a noose?
So as I said, kind of at the end of that last segment, people backed up both sides of their group's story. Those who are with Vox said they heard someone call for a noose and told everyone to leave so they could hang him, while those with Purdy say that never happened, and they were just restraining Vox because they thought he was going to keep allegedly punching people. One thing that I should mention is that according to the one officer's report, Vox wasn't the one who brought the noose up. One of his friends said he had heard someone call for a noose, and I'm going to read the report here verbatim. Quote, Mr. Booker then stated that he heard the same remarks, but had forgot about them earlier. End quote. Another thing I'll mention is Purdy was wearing a Confederate flag hat. There was some uncertainty online about Vox's claim that people were wearing Confederate hats. There are no stars and bars visible in the video he shared. But Purdy told the DNR officer that he thought Booker came back to their property because he didn't like Purdy's hat.
Okay, so the Monroe County Prosecutor's Office has filed charges, but the FBI has been investigating the incident as a hate crime. Does this impact that at all?
No. So the FBI investigation is a federal investigation, and the DNR one is state level. So they're unrelated. I spoke with Booker's attorney, Kitty Lyle, this morning, and she says the FBI investigation is important because the agency is investigating it as a hate crime.
Really quick, have you gotten a chance to speak to the attorneys for Cox and Purdy?
No. So the Associated Press reached out to David Hennessy, who's representing Purdy, and he had no comment.
All right, Mitch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
In Portland, Oregon, protests against police brutality and racism have continued for over 50 consecutive days. The Trump administration has recently responded by deploying federal officers, some of whom are unidentifiable and driving unmarked vehicles, to arrest those protesters. And that's been happening since at least July 14th, according to local reports. So far, more than 400 protesters have been arrested since May. We're joined by Jonathan Levinson, a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting based out of Portland. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I started seeing early reports of these officers, I don't know how we would characterize them, dressed in fatigues. When did you all first hear about what was happening? Because it wasn't until you all confirmed what was happening that I knew that this was in fact really happening.
Yeah, federal officers started making an appearance at the protests, I guess you could say, around July 1st. And at that point, they were coming out and sort of clearing the protesters away from the federal courthouse. And then on July 4th, they made a really big show of force and cleared protesters away from the federal courthouse with tear gas and impact munitions, and then kept going into the park across the street in that city property, and then kept going beyond that. And they were joined then by Portland police and were clearing for multiple city blocks well past any federal property. And that was the sort of their first big show of force where it was clear that they were going to be taking a more proactive role. And then these the use of unmarked vehicles. We saw videos posted on Twitter of them driving around downtown late at night in unmarked minivans. And I started reaching out to people and, you know, looking for people who had been arrested, and came across Mark Pettibone and his story. You know, he was at a protest downtown, him and a friend, at about 2:30 in the morning, walking back to their car. And they bumped into a group on the way back to their car who told them that there had been a minivan driving around with guys in camouflage in it. About a half a block later, minivan pulls up, four or five guys jump out. They grab Mark, they pull a beanie down over his head so he can't see, and toss him in the van, hold his arms over his head, and drive him around for a little bit. And then he ends up getting unloaded inside a building, which later he would learn was the federal courthouse.
Jonathan, this feels, I'm not going to say it's unprecedented, because we're now, you know, today we have the use of video, which, you know, we hadn't had for much of our history. So, but this just feels bizarre. I mean, to use a word that we can use on public radio, to say the least, what is going on in Portland with these officers?
I mean, it does feel bizarre. I think that's an understatement, like you said. I was interviewing a freelance reporter here, Tuck Woodstock, getting their sense of what had been going on. And they said something interesting that actually really resonated, which is when the report of the minivans came out, they weren't super shocked. And that was because over the past 50 plus days, there had just been a steady escalation. You know, the Portland police stopped using their name tags on their uniforms, and they were using impact munitions and tear gas, and protesters had been severely injured. And then the federal police showed up and they started doing sort of more of the same. And so when these reports started coming out, it just felt like the next sort of incremental step. And it wasn't until, even for me, writing this story and seeing the response that I realized just how terrible it was.
You mentioned local police stopped using their name badges or started covering their names so they were unidentifiable. So this has been a slow escalation. Jonathan, who is directing this? Is this coming all the way from the top cop, if you will, Attorney General Bill Barr? Is it coming from local police departments? Is this a federal directive?
There are many chains of command at play here. I mean, when it comes to Portland police, it is certainly a local thing. It is the city that is in control. The name tags with Portland police, that is because they were concerned about their officers getting doxxed. Federal police, this was done in response to the president signed an executive order on June 26th to protect statues and monuments and to address what he called criminal violence. In response to that, Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice sent federal officers to various cities in the country. I think it was Seattle, Washington, D.C., Gettysburg National Park in Pennsylvania, and Portland. And so what we are told is that when federal officers are responsible for federal property and city police are responsible for the city, and that when federal officers, when they are clearing city streets, that there are two totally separate chains of command, that Portland police chief is in charge of Portland police and federal police are in charge of themselves. And so even when they're acting together, it's two separate chains of command.
But Jonathan, that still doesn't explain this idea of grabbing Americans off of the streets, stuffing them into the back of a van, and then throwing them into a federal courthouse without having explained why, what the charges are, what the grievances are, or any of that. This just feels, now the ACLU has been on the ground there calling this, quote, flat out unconstitutional. Tell me a little bit about the challenges to this behavior that are coming right now.
The mayor has said, you know, if the federal officers can't stay inside their buildings, then they should leave. The governor has said that their presence is a provocation. Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden have said that they are going to introduce an amendment to the defense bill this week to prevent what Senator Merkley called, I think he said paramilitary soldiers in American cities or something along those lines. The Oregon Attorney General is opening an investigation into the U.S. Marshal who shot and severely injured a protester here with an impact munition. Colloquially, rubber bullets, they're actually, there's various forms. Some of them are little plastic munitions, and some of them are larger, really hard foam rounds, and they cause severe damage. I mean, they've killed protesters, they've blinded protesters, yeah.
I don't want to take anything away from Oregon state officials, but is that enough?
I mean, I think if for people on the ground here, once you start getting into these political machinations, right, and, you know, senators in D.C. doing their thing and the governor doing their thing, it does feel like quite an abstraction when every single night you're out there getting tear gassed and getting shot at. Is it enough? I know that, you know, last night there were still hundreds of people out protesting, and again, they got tear gassed, so nothing's changed so far.
Well, but getting tear gassed is different than getting picked up off of the street, shoved into the back of a van. I mean, are we still seeing that type of behavior too, what one of the officials called paramilitary behavior?
We, and this doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but we have not seen it happen since this story came out. At the same time, Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security Ken Cuccinelli did say that this is a tactic they use. He didn't disavow it. He didn't say that they're going to stop doing it.
Well, Cuccinelli, to that point, also said this is something that they use nationally, not just in Oregon.
Correct. Again, I haven't seen reports of it being used in other cities, but I would imagine if it is, that we would start hearing about it more.
Jonathan Levinson is a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting based in Portland. Jonathan, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Hear these words. You will never be ignored again. Your voice, your hopes, and your dreams will define our American destiny. And your courage and goodness and love will forever guide us along the way. Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
President Trump says he's sending federal law enforcement officers to Chicago and other U.S. cities to fight what he says is violent crime that's spiraling out of control. Mr. Trump said recent anti-racism demonstrations on the streets of American cities represented what he described as an effort to shut down policing. He said the federal agents would help police in communities plagued by violence.
This rampage of violence shocks the conscience of our nation, and we will not stand by and watch it happen. Can't do that. The citizens of Chicago are citizens of America, and they have the same right as every other American to live in safety, dignity, and peace. Every American, no matter their income, their race, or their zip code, should be able to walk their city streets free from violence and free from fear. For this reason, today, I am announcing that the Department of Justice will immediately surge federal law enforcement to the city of Chicago.
This comes after federal law enforcement officials were controversially deployed to Portland to put down protests there. 15 mayors of major U.S. cities have sent a letter to U.S. federal law enforcement officials demanding a stop to such deployments. One of the signatories is the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio.
So what we see in Portland is that the federal presence is actually making the situation worse, and we cannot allow that here in New York City nor anywhere else in the country. I want to be very, very clear that we will not allow this to happen in our city. And if we see these federal officers on our streets, then we will see the Trump administration in court to stop it from happening.
Standing next to President Trump during the announcement, the Attorney General William Barr said the federal police officers would work in close coordination with local police forces. Our correspondent in Washington is Barbara Plett-Usher. She told me what the federal officers would be doing.
The Attorney General said that the law allows the federal officers to take action against gang activity and gun violence in American cities, and that there are already existing task forces that bring together various federal agents in these cities to do exactly that. So the extra forces are going to go to these task forces and work with them and bolster them in anti-crime activity. He called it classic anti-crime stuff, which involved the detective work and also solving crimes and going after gangsters, basically. So he talked about it as a way to reinforce something that was existing, but that needed to be stepped up because of the step up in crime.
Several mayors have written to the U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, asking him not to send the federal officers. Why is their deployment so controversial?
Their deployment has been controversial because the agents that have already been deployed were sent without the approval of local authorities. And I think we can talk about Portland, Oregon here, which has been the most controversial. There, what you had was federal agents coming in to protect federal buildings against anti-racist protesters. These are the protesters who have been demanding an end to police brutality since the death of George Floyd in May, and they had been roiling Portland since that time. So it was a difficult situation, and the local officials said the injection of federal agents had just made it worse, that they'd come in with no local oversight. They were violating the civil rights of protesters, and they were just inflaming the situation. And I think that caused many mayors to be worried about the injection of federal agents. Attorney General Barr did distinguish between the operation in Portland and this one. He went to some length to talk about crime fighting versus going in to deal with a civil unrest situation. And he also went to some length to say there are existing structures for this, and we will be coordinating with local authorities over this. And the mayor of Chicago, who was very strongly against this deployment to begin with because of what happened in Portland, has since toned down her objections and seems to have been at least somewhat convinced that there will be more coordination on this.
President Trump presumably thinks this is going to help him win November's election. Is he right?
Well, it's too early to say, but what I can say is that he did frame his remarks in a very political terms. So he said that the protesters who have been demanding an end to police brutality, and as part of that, they have been asking for a shift in resources away from the police. He said that that had weakened the police, that that's why crime had surged, this was his interpretation, and that Democratic politicians were approving this agenda, and therefore the left as a whole, he was talking about, was vilifying the police. He was coming in to save the police, but also to bolster crime fighting. And that is very much being, being inventive with the situation that's happening, and it's bending it to his interpretation of himself as a law and order president, something that he is going to be running on for the presidential election.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 25, 2020, so I have been told. Last Saturday of July. Let's get right to it. Compensatory call-in and all that, blah, blah, blah. So, here in Seattle, best plantation in the known universe, they had a protest in solidarity with the protest that's happening, or the protest that's been going on for 2 months or so in Portland. Portland is about a 3 hour drive south of Seattle, straight drive. Fewer black people in Portland, smaller city than Seattle, but pretty close, lots of travel back and forth, commuters and all the like. So they had a solidarity protest today here in Seattle. Lovely weather today here in Seattle, sunny. It's like 77 degrees. I might even be lying. Let's see. I don't even know if it's 77. It's not very warm even. So sunny summer day. So they went out, they had their protest, and they sent out an alert at around 4:30 that the protest had been labeled a riot. I forgot if it was the mayor or if it was the police, but according to someone's set criteria, this is no longer a protest, this is now a riot, and they were conducting themselves accordingly. But my head dropped immediately. President Trump has been talking tough about my beloved city for a long time, and he's got his list of cities where federal troops were coming. I said, oh man, it's going to be the same thing here. And then I saw that, oh man. Pray for Gus T. Staying in the house. I've been staying in the house anyway. I have done a pretty good job of avoiding the protest areas. For the most part, they have been like right in the center of downtown Capitol Hill, which is, you know, like a 10-minute walk, where I guess you all don't know. Capitol Hill is like a 10-minute walk from downtown, so that's still pretty close. Some regions, all of that might be considered downtown together, but anyway, all of that's kind of close. And then there were some protests in the U District, which is north of downtown, and then they had some protests in Bellevue, which is a little suburb to the outskirts of, well, not even outskirts, it's 10 minutes. And in some other regions, that would just all be a part of the same city. But here, that is the suburbs, and they had some protests there and other locations. So, but for the most part, I've done a pretty good job of staying away from those areas. I already did a program where I told you how I felt just going downtown and being in Capitol Hill and some of the different areas. And it looked like a war zone. I felt like I could die in the next 5 minutes or less easily. We did a whole podcast about that back about a month ago. Nothing has changed. Now it's about to get worse. White people, and they even had a report earlier today where black members of the NAACP in Portland were saying that they think, they didn't use the word clowning. They said that, I have to go back to look at the report to get the exact terminology that they used in their description. Let's see if I can find it really quick. It was white spectacle. That was the terminology they used, which is interesting because we have talked about the book Lynching as Spectacle before. And so this, you've had a black man on our job, is Amy Wood. We talked about that, Lynching as Spectacle. But yeah, this was just today. The white people running around in the streets in Portland and Seattle, same thing, 3-hour drive difference. As white spectacle, white clowning. When I say clowning, I mean white people. They're not really serious about solving the problem of white supremacy racism. In fact, that's what was being said in this report. Portland NAACP president on protests as a white spectacle, that this is not even about racism anymore. They're protesting about, you know, whatever. Or just, like I said, the clowning element. Oh, man, we've been stuck in the house. We don't have any sports, anything. Like, man. Oh, we're going to go protest. Let's go protest. Let's go. Yes, thank God. Get out of the house. Get to break a few things. I don't like police anyway. Hurl a brick. Saving a few bricks anyway. Clowning. That's what I've called it. Lots of that been going on all throughout the world, really, but certainly here in the Pacific Northwest, for sure. Let's see. The list of all of that, again, to say, wow. Seattle might not be the best plantation anymore. Like, very sad day for Gus T. Very dangerous out here in these parts. I felt it was super dangerous anyway, but federal troops, that is not an improvement. And they are talking about defunding the police here in Seattle. That's not going to make anything better either. Just have more armed white people. Washington State is gun territory, meaning they're all about guns and going out and shooting. I don't know if people probably have not been to Washington State. It is a very rural area, except for Seattle. It's like, if you haven't been here, like, it's like Kentucky or like Arkansas. Once you get out of Seattle, like Seattle, obviously, big city, like, okay, all that. But once you get away from that, like, woo, it is Scunland. Anyway, Whitelandia, speaking of Gunland. So, wow, this has been easily one of the worst years in my time on the planet, and I've heard the same from almost everybody on the planet. However, within all of that, the cow's timing has been pretty remarkable. Said that many times throughout our history, but this year, like, wow. So, if I can do this in order. Number one, Whitelandia. There's a documentary project titled Whitelandia about the history of white supremacy racism in Portland and even in the in Oregon, Portland specifically. And they talk about, you know, them having in the Oregon Constitution, state constitution, no Negroes allowed. And I don't even think that that's been, like, repealed formally. So that might technically still be the law in Oregon. They don't have a lot of Negroes down there. Anyway, so we had Tracy McDonald. She's a white woman, suspected racist, and her white partner for the film. They were on the program. Man, talk about the cow's time. So they were on the program November 2014. What was significant about the date they were on the program, it was the date they announced that Michael Brown Jr.'s killer would not be indicted. And they so-called rioted that night as well. But that was the evening that we had Tracy McDonald on talk about Whitelandia. It was scheduled like way in advance. And that was like a makeup date because her daughter broke her nose and all this. So finally get around to doing the program on this date. So we are talking about their film, but, you know, obviously because it took a while. Like it was announced late at night. If people recall, it was primetime television, like 8 p.m. that night, I think like 8 p.m. Eastern or something like that, but it was late in the evening. The sun had gone down and all that, and it's November, so it's cold. But they won the program, so we talked about that in their documentary. So I thought, oh, wow, that's right. We talked to a number of folks in the state of Oregon, like check in with some of them about all this madness happening down there. So I contact Tracy McDonald, and she writes back and she said, wow, that's surprising because I was literally just talking about you and recalling our interview from 2014, the night the indictment was, or non-indictment was announced. So we'll see if we can get her on to report on what is happening in Oregon. You can look in the archives for that program. So our timing has been impeccable this year. Number two, we are currently reading Romaine Gary's White Dog. Fascinating book. Threatening my top 10. I'm not pleased about that because I don't even think that this book is well written. But wow, does it reveal a lot about what it means to be white. Amazing. We have read two segments. Penises. What to say? If you have not been following the book club, you are missing out. I told you, I had someone ask me the other day, tell me some books to read on racism, white supremacy. I said, White Dog. I didn't say the ISIS papers, the code book. Now, I eventually did give them a big list that did have all those books on it. But, man, book number one was White Dog. Police Dog. They changed that in the movie. They didn't make it a police dog in the movie. Reading is more important than watching television. A police dog that has been trained to attack black people. And this is allegedly based on true happenings. So that's our book for the book club. A cow's investor listening to the book club said, hey, this is constructive. Look at here. I found this report. See if I can be professional and give you the full title. He says, I found this report. It's free. You can download it. It's titled Slave Hounds and Abolition in the Americas. And it was published this year, no less. So he says, you should check this out. It's talking about how race soldiers, they used white dogs to patrol the plantation and terrorize the Negroes on the plantation. And then if they tried to escape, they'd have the hounds, you know, track them down and everything. I said, wow, this is fascinating. Not that, you know, it was unheard of or anything I didn't believe or what have you. Just, this is great, you know, historical context, because I think this is true. Having these dogs trained to attack black people, I've heard it too many times. So, I email the co-author of this report, Dr. Tyler Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. I email him. He's in Nevada, read in Ohio. I email him and tell him, you know, we're reading White Dog and how I found his work. You know, we're reading White Dog. Listener found your work on Dog's Role on the Plantation. Would be great to have you chatted up on the program. This is what he writes me back. Let's see. Yeah, I'll give it to you exactly. I'll verbatim. He says, thanks so much for this note. It's interesting that you reached out at this moment, as I am currently drafting a book proposal for an analysis of White Dog, the history of the work from book to film, and the social context under which it was released, and the controversies that ensued. I've been obsessed with White Dog since someone first mentioned it to me about 5 years ago. Now, I've known about this film for a decade. Just got around to reading the book. This would be the book that follows my forthcoming co-authored book on the history of canines and anti-black racism. I was planning to complete my research for it this summer, but the Rona shut down the library resources that I needed. Anyway, I'm very glad to be invited to discuss this topic and would love to be on the program. He should be with us on Tuesday. Timing has been impeccable. Impeccable this year. Like, wow. Very lousy. Hasn't been helpful in too many ways. But Dr. Perry, he will be here with us. If you are listening, for folks who have just been following along with the book club, oh man, front and center, let's roll. This Tuesday we will chat it up about the plantation canines, and then we'll get to White Dog as well. Spectacular. We'll be really ready for this coming Thursday. If you have not been listening to the book club, there is a reason. Romaine Gary's White Dog, which was published in 1970, 50 years ago, even that, to be reading it 50 years from when it was published. There is a reason this book is on Amazon for $700. $1,000 on some web. There is a reason you have to shell out that many nickels to get this here book. Whew. All right, next on the list. Last two things, and then we'll get the folks who dialed in. It's like, what a year it has been in the system of racism. We could have had 3 hours of news clips today easily as well. So we will be, not next weekend, but 2 weeks from now, I guess we'll see how it goes. That's been the whole year. So if the federal troops have not get nabbed Gus T, if I have not been labeled a black identity extremist, I am not somewhere alongside Bill Cosby. We should be in Washington, D.C. In 2 weeks. COW's counter-racist yoga retreat. We were forced to cancel Toronto. The border is still closed. We were forced to cancel Toronto. I'm still very disgruntled about that. Lots of losses this year. But we are moving ahead. Washington, D.C. And we will see, you know, could be in greater confinement or anything by then, with federal troops moving into this area. But hunkering down, stand low. Hopefully we'll be in D.C. for the counter-racist yoga retreat, do some yoga, have some veggie meals, taking super precautions. We have a residence with a big backyard, so we will be spending lots of time outside, socially distanced, to do our meals and all that good stuff. I thought way back when this was being planned at the beginning of the year, I thought I was being cool and getting a residence with AC, and, you know, that way we could kick back and do mint julep or whatever they do in the South during the hot, humid summers. I did not think, oh man, AC won't even matter because you'll probably want to be outside to... Anyway, so that is 2 weeks we will be in D.C. with all the wackiness of the year. We had someone who had already paid their deposit and everything to be there, and then with all of the chaos, now cannot be with us. So we actually have a spot, one. If you would like to come hang out, it'd actually be discounted because, you know, they already paid the deposit. So if you would like to hang out, one, if there's one person. I thought there might be somebody in the D.C. area. Drop an email. Let me know. If not, we will be hanging out safely, doing some yoga, wearing masks, socially distanced in D.C. for a few days. Have to see. Just have to see. I feel like with the way this year has gone, D.C., a volcanic eruption might happen between now and then. There might be a lake of lava flowing down K Street. Like, anything between now and then. So we'll just have to see how it goes. But safety and everything pending. Couple of weeks, D.C. Let's see. And with that, we will get to the callers. The number, new number, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 716. New number, still learning myself. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You can take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations. If federal troops are coming to your city or are already there in increased volume, that would be good to know. If we have parents, how you are adjusting the coming school year, that would also be good to know if that's impacting your work schedule. You can share about that as well. But 5 minutes, if you have comments, observations to share, just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be spectacular. Just helps to keep us from having to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. For this one broadcast, I request if we could not use metaphors. A lot of times, well, one, racists, they will use lots of metaphors to practice deception. A lot of times they'll take two separate concepts and they will insist that they are identical. Frequently, that is the deception. Victims of white supremacy, Gus T. included, have been exposed to this misconduct for a lot of years, and we're still learning. So sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our thoughts, and so in its place, we will use an analogy or simile or something, and often all this does is contribute to more confusion. If we could be direct, precise, specific with what it is we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Number again, new number, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in. If you have thoughts to share, line should be open. Feel free.
Hi, Jeff.
Be in Toronto. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, greetings to you, callers and listeners. Been listening to some of the news clips. The one that, well, there were several that were very interesting. But the one that really alarmed me was in terms of the police taking protesters, putting them in the back of vehicles, and then dropping them off at a federal courthouse, if I've heard it correctly. It's something that would often be heard being done in other countries, you know, such as, Germany, back around World War II, or in other places where, the rights of civilians are not being respected. And it's very, I'd like to say, Gestapo tactics. So it's really interesting that these techniques are being done. I'm pretty sure that those techniques have been done for quite some time. It's just that now that, it's coming out more, apparent as to what is happening to individuals. So I found that quite alarming, and even more of a reason for everyone to self-preserve the life of yourself as well as the life of your families and friends. These are definitely dangerous times, in particular for Black people under the system of white supremacy. Thank you so much. And I lose the line.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto. I thought last week, because they started talking about Portland and the federal troops going there, I thought that was really important, and more time, energy should have been spent discussing that on the compensatory call-in from last weekend. I did have an audio report, but we didn't really spend much time discussing it last week, but I thought that was hugely important. And I was just thinking that, like, if you can send them to Portland, you certainly could send them to Seattle or Chicago, Charlottesville, any other place that you think, you know, NICRAs have gotten out of hand or whatever the excuse is. And there you go. Seattle probably next. Maybe your city near you. That would be another great reason to kind of be in the house, as I have been saying. But proceed. Other folks with a hand up that we have missed totally, proceed. Let's see. But I got, while folks are getting their thoughts together, the New York Times had a fascinating report this week. I'll see if I can pull it up in the interim. I guess you'll kind of have to pay attention, because I'm going to see if we can chat it up with Tracy McDonald. Like I said, white woman involved with the documentary project Whitelandia on Portland. I'm going to see if we can get her on the program sometime soon. So you'll probably just need to check Black Talk Radio Network or Facebook. I'll probably put it on Twitter as well when it's scheduled and we have a date and time and everything. But we'll definitely be here Tuesday for Dr. Perry. Let's see. The New York Times report. Let's see. Yes, here we go. So this is from July 21st, day or two, kind of the beginning of the week here. This is on the New York Times. Not going to read the entire report. A new public service announcement makes a point that federal leaders have largely overlooked. Asian Americans are facing a surge of harassment linked to fears about the coronavirus pandemic. The spot, which debuted on Tuesday, includes testimonials from a firefighter, a nurse, a driver, an artist, the celebrity chef Melissa King, and others who describe being told to go back to China or having people spit in their direction. The somber ad produced by the nonprofit Advertising Council with help from the Emmy writing writer Alan Yang ends with a request, fight the virus, fight the bias. Anxiety about the novel respiratory virus, which was first detected in Wuhan, China, has fueled xenophobia and bigotry toward people of Asian descent. A coalition of civil rights groups recorded more than 2,100 incidents in 15 weeks. The New York City Commission on Human Rights recently described a sharp increase in instances of hostility and harassment. A list of recent cases compiled by the Anti-Defamation League chronicles surging reports of xenophobic, is that that word again? I thought I just said that, and racist incidents, including Asian-owned stores defaced with racist graffiti, video chats disrupted by anti-Asian comments, and people being beaten or denied entry to business. President Trump has repeatedly described the coronavirus as the Chinese virus, and in recent weeks as Kung Flu, despite saying publicly that it is very important that we totally protect our Asian American community in the United States. And we'll stop there. But this is in the New York Times. I say, for one, for our listeners, I guess I could say, for one, Akai Gurley. For two, I said, wow, you know, white supremacy, racism, not bias. White supremacy, racism is a global problem. All kinds of non-white people are mistreated. All of that is what we are trying to solve. System of justice. But man, I have not seen any New York Times reports like, wow, niggers are catching it. Did you see they are strangling black children in the street and pulling guns on black mothers and black children who are just driving? Did you see this is happening everywhere? And they had all those reports of racists using firecrackers. And I mean, we can't even count them. I haven't seen any of those reports. And I mean, I couldn't even count. I said it before. It was unprecedented. I said it 2 weeks in a row. It was unprecedented, the number of attacks that I saw against black people. They can't even count the number of strange black suicides that look like public hangings. They can't even count all the numbers of those cases. And I haven't seen one report from the New York Times or another mainstream outlet like, wow, the number of cases of black people being attacked is just spiraling. It's amazing. System of racism, white supremacy, black get back. No one should be mistreated. Akai Gurley. Other folks who dialed in, you have a hand up, thoughts to share, line should be open.
Greetings, everyone. Greetings, Gus.
Greetings, greetings. Retired firefighter.
Just wanted to make sure I was heard. Yes, I have just three reports. Pretty soon, the DCS mentoring program will start up again. There was a problem governor of the state of Florida cut the compensation from a state level that the DCS program was supposed to be getting, but we're still going to be able to be functional because of the other funding that that is geared towards the program. Mr. Clark came up with some interesting shirts. I can't explain it because I don't have it in front of me. I only saw it once, but I'll bring it up maybe a couple of weeks from now when I'm able to see what the shirt is saying, because I forgot. Heard an interesting report on the global radio channel. I just can't think of what it is. It was talking about the faction of racism, white supremacy in the place that is called Italy. Most of the non-white black people who are in Italy started coming into that part of the world in and around the 70s and the 80s. And part of the other than the obvious of, you know, white people not wanting non-white people around them, the way that they do it in that particular part of the world to keep that antagonism and whatnot up is by stating that you, although you're born in Italy, you still can't become a citizen. You would have to wait until you're 18 years old, and you have from 18 years to 19 years old to apply for citizenship. If you miss that particular point in time in your age, it will be missing forever. That means you would never be a citizen. And they mentioned, you know, about the portions of the world that where you're born, you become a quote-unquote citizen, such as in the concept that is called the United States. Last but not least, NFAC. I heard that they had another rally in Louisville, Kentucky. And as I can imagine, when you have a whole lot of people who I would state that are probably most of them are inexperienced with firearms, let alone talking about firearms that are more complicated than others, assault rifles, that sort of thing, you're going to have the potential for quote-unquote accidents, and in turn, three people were wounded in that occasion. If you can see me now, I'm just shaking my head. That's the only thing I can do. I have no the comment other than a huge VGQ, on that particular type of venture. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. It could get worse.
Federal troops could be coming soon. It's been my experience, because I do hear a lot of talk, certainly not from Cal's listeners, but I do tend to hear a lot of people take the position that white people are dumb and stupid and ignorant about all kinds of things. Well, it's my experience that white people tend not to be the ones stumbling and fumbling and ignorant about firearms. They tend to be real informed. And the folks who get labeled as federal officers, oh man, you want to talk about codification with a firearm? That's what it's going to be. So, yeah, it probably could get substantially worse, even though I think that's in the code book, recommended not to say things could be worse, but neither here nor there. Yeah, that's pretty embarrassing. Since we mentioned the code book, what did he say?
I can hear the laughter.
Hang on one second. It's primitive, pitiful, and stupid. That's the way it's written, and I think that
qualifies for what I heard. And I think we said, because we went, even retired firefighter who mentioned that, he was praised for his acumen, codification really, at the gun range and helping some of us others who were novices, you know, hadn't been out there, amateurs, novices, we hadn't done any shooting before, and he was super helpful in making sure we weren't making those type of errors so we could be safe as we practice. I think we said codification is important if you're going to start to talk about firearms or counter violence. That's all I was going to say. You going to add something, firefighter, retired firefighter?
Yes, I can hear the laughter. I can hear the laughter of white people. The YouTube would be full of white people making fun of this particular venture. It is predictable. As far as the mistakes that people would make, because a lot of firearms are almost like exact machines, and if you have a jam in the machine and you don't know what you're doing and try to eliminate that jam, that weapon could discharge and harm a lot of people, let alone talking about why they are there and who they keep challenging over and over again. If the old saying is you need to be careful of what you ask for. And that's all I'd say. Thank you.
Very important. Retired firefighter in Florida. New number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. They had the
hello.
Oh, was that Irie in Louisiana? Whew. Might be sending federal troops to New Orleans. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? You were saying something. I don't want to interrupt you. You were about to say something.
Thank you. I was just quickly, the retired firefighter, he mentioned the group of victims of white supremacy. They were having I don't know what how they phrased it, a march or demonstration of some sort against racism, white supremacy, and they were doing so with arms in Kentucky. Just all of that, I cannot emphasize how many white people badge and no badge out with guns. Like, you already have a pretty dangerous situation. I would probably avoid anything like that. Irie in Louisiana, thank you.
Yes, I agree. You know, as much as I agree with us practicing self-defense, we're severely outnumbered, armed, and it's just, it's pretty pitiful, the state we're in. But again, this is people trying to express to their best degree how bad the situation is, that they're actually beginning to be bold enough to stand out their weapons, you know. It's desperation. The only thing left, honestly, would be tactics used in the so-called Middle East, you know, suicide bombing and stuff. And then that won't even solve it, really. That'll just end up with the remaining some of us just being corralled. But speaking of that, I laughed at the white people that got thrown into the vans. You know, this is what you all wanted. This is, all this stuff is y'all fault, for the ones that's gonna listen. I say ha-ha to it. You didn't think you could be thrown into the back of the van. It was okay as long as non-white people were getting done in. Now you're getting done in, and it's, of course, it's injustice. White supremacy is practiced by white supremacists, and a lot of racists, in my opinion, are not white supremacists to the degree that they will go ahead and sacrifice another white person, e.g. by putting them into the back of a van and pulling their beanies over their head. And these racists are too puerile to understand that. When I listened to the Reggie Nicholson story and I heard the man talk about how basically incarcerating people just didn't make financial sense, I said, you know what, conservatives are just racists who use coupons. And that's a metaphor, but it's true. They are still racist. It's just they like money a little bit better at times. I'll say that. I saw something interesting on YouTube, and I did watch a little bit of it, and then I turned it off. Some white guy has made a documentary called the Trayvon Martin Hoax, something like that. And claims there's a real Diamond Eugene that is not the one that was seen at the trial. The depiction that they presented, or the producers or whatever presented, is of a smaller, what they would consider, most people would consider like a better looking, non-white black female. And then he shows like some scenes of him going into, quote, Little Haiti, and asking people, can I find Diamond? Can you help me? Can you help me? And it was reminiscent of, like, you know, him going on like, you know how white people go on these jungle safaris and they go through this tough terrain to get to something mystical, something, you know, evasive and whatnot. That's when I cut it off. But there's more lies and more creation of scary black people, or, you know, just black people who have managed to get away with starting something that has basically, in this man's words, you know, set off, you know, a division in America, paraphrasing, but that's his opinion, that Trayvon Martin did it, that murder, terroristic murder did it. I hope I'm not taking too long. Let me know, Gus, how much time I got. But I was watching a black male professor try to teach white people about racism, and he said something that really gave me a headache. He said that, you know, during the early days of enslavement, 18th century or so, white people could get prime loans against their slaves, or a prime mortgage. He said that exactly, prime mortgage. And that backed up what I read in American Slave Post in the chapter Wake Up Rich. And I said, okay, prime mortgage, why would that be the terms? And then something in my head said, now think of where else you've heard that. And I said, I've heard that after the so-called bubble, the housing market so-called bubble. And I thought, okay, prime loans, subprime loans, why would it be subprime? And then I think God basically was teaching me in that moment that basically when they gave out these fouled loans to non-white people, especially black, they called them subprime because essentially white people are able to leverage financially on the work and the lives of non-white people. Therefore, their loans are prime and intended for them. When a non-white person, especially a black person, tries to get a loan or a mortgage, they're ultimately getting it against oneself. It's not prime. You're subprime. Therefore, it's a subprime loan or mortgage. So they're still using slave terms in banking, and when I explain this to white, I guess this lady's white or whatever, she says she's a gypsy, she's a friend of mine, but I'm slowly losing that as an option. You know, I tried to explain this to her, and she's like, it doesn't matter. It's not what you say, it's not what they say, da-da-dee-da-da-da. And I'm like, you know what, lost cause, but it just really gave me a headache, the fact that I'm subprime, I'm sub, you know, mortal, whatever, can't borrow no money to try to get ahead. And if I do, they're going to bet against it, you know, because it was intended for me and you in the first place. And my last announcement,
30 seconds.
I try to keep up with it. And yes, I try to keep up with this as much as possible. You can Google this. According to white people at NASA, there is an asteroid with a trajectory of somewhere in midland China that should hit, they said it's equivalent to what they think killed the dinosaurs by 2027. They've sent out rendezvous drones to, I guess, see what they can do with it or if they can destroy it. I don't know. As soon as you Google it, it's a PowerPoint presentation. You can Google it. More information that's just not being talked about in the midst of so-called corona and increasing and ever-enduring racism, white supremacy. I hope everyone stays safe.
Much obliged, Irie. Stay safe indeed. I will say conversation when you were talking to this person who describes herself as a gypsy, whatever that means. The classifications. White person, non-white person. It's not a whole lot of, you know, gypsy. What? I would be very mindful. Because you said twice, I think you said it, that talking to her and just the dialogue, it kind of gave you a headache. And words have power, right? And even logic is powerful. Logic can help us get things done. Conversely, when people are using words incorrectly, when people are discouraging you from using logic, that also can be very powerful in a non-constructive way, but powerful nonetheless. Has an impact. She said she had a headache. Said it twice, actually. And I heard that, heard, observed it, experienced it myself. I'd say all of us, I think everybody here on the planet is already experiencing enough like stress, anxiety, things to bother us about this year or to be concerned about with this year. If we're talking to somebody else, in particular, if there's some confusion or ambiguity about their racial classification, like, oh, man, I'm not fixing to, you know, have my blood pressure going up and having palpitations talking to you about white supremacy, racism. I think that's why Mr. Fuller coined the phrase VGQ, but I would make a very quick assessment, probably for the rest of the year. Like, all right, am I talking to someone who's being logical? Particularly, are they listening if I ask a question or just point out that maybe something they said might not be accurate, might not be logical, or are they just going to talk down to me? She said subprime. Are they going to talk down to me, talk over me, that type of thing? Am I just going to get upset? And although I would make that assessment really quick because we don't need any extra strife this year. Like, if that is the case, this person is not interested or they're confused or maybe this is a, you know, racist that I'm talking to. You know, she just had me confused. Whatever the case is, I'm not even getting into that. I already got enough strife. We'll just end this conversation or switch, talk about something else. And if we can't do that, well, then, hey, you already said, man, I need to reevaluate, you know, who I think is a friend. Maybe, yeah, maybe this isn't, you know, it's ran its course. Well, I won't even use it. I'll reevaluate this relationship and if we need to have a whole lot of contact in the future. Always good to make reassessments. Other folks, we've missed totally. Star 6-1, proceed.
Gus, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gus. Good evening. I would just like to know the radio station that retired firefighter was listening to, because I took your advice. I listened to news from all over the world, other than in the United States. I listened to France 24. They have a lot of stuff, good information on white supremacy, racism. And there's another TV station out too. It's called RT.com, and they have a lot of good constructive information. So if the retired firefighter will be so kind to re-announce what radio station he listened to, I'll really appreciate it. And thanks, Gus. Thanks for everything.
We do what we can.
WLRN.
Oh, okay.
I believe it's WLRN. Okay, thank you, sir.
Nice. Let's see.
You're welcome.
Other folks that we missed, if you have commentary, proceed. See, I see hands up. I guess folks are getting their thoughts together.
Hi, Gus.
Oh, be in Toronto. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, so sorry to interrupt. I was just looking on the NASA information regarding the asteroid. It says here that the impact is predicted July 21st, 2027. That at first it was detected back in 2017. And that it should, the possible regions affected may be China, North, South Korea, Japan, and into the Pacific. If yourself, callers, and listeners are interested, I'm just trying to get the, what I did was I looked on the Google search of asteroid heading for Earth to hit China, and then I went on to, the first result, which was https://cneos.jpl.nasa.gov, and it's a PDF. So that will give more information with respect to the asteroid predicted to head towards Earth. Thank you so much, and I'll leave the line.
Much obliged. We don't even have quarters right now. We might not even make it to 2025, much less 2027. The coin, I forgot about that. Man, are they having a coin shortage in Canada? Let's see if that's just the U.S. thing. Is there a coin shortage in Canada, be in Toronto, to your knowledge?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I know that we've discontinued the penny. So the least denomination we have now is the nickel or 5 cents. Not aware of a coin shortage. At least it hasn't made the headlines.
Okay.
But we'll look into it. I can look into it right now, actually. And I can keep you posted before the end of the show or program.
Yes, ma'am. We'll see if that's just the U.S. thing or if it's global. Just add that in terms of the strife in the U.S. I was not aware of that until this week. I was at the bank. A suspected racist was in line, socially distanced, with a mask on. I had a mask on, too. She was down the row a little bit, and she was trying to get quarters. And the teller, non-white female, said, oh, I'm sorry, ma'am, we can't give you any quarters.
And the white woman, she got like extra sarcastic. It wasn't necessarily like she was hostile per se, but it was that sarcasm like, what? Is there a national shortage of quarters? And the non-white teller looked at her. She was so straight-faced, no giggle. Yes. And the white woman, she was, it was like she was so stunned. She was speechless, like she didn't even have a response, nothing, just like, what? Now, I did crack up laughing, because I mean, but it took me a few seconds, like, wait, that's what I mean, like, 2027, like, we are not going to make it to the end of the year. Like, we don't have toilet paper, no quarters, like, man. I don't know if that has impacted folks, other folks in the States, but they do have lots of reports and explanations as for why that is. Of course, that is Rona-related, but, man, add that to if we make it through all of this and we get past the asteroid, if we are looking back, grandchildren and all the rest, like, wow, we didn't have quarters. There were armed white people on every corner. You had to fight people off for toilet paper and hand sanitizer, like, I don't know how we survived. Like, man. Other folks who dialed in that we had missed totally.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Beth.
Can we hang tight? Just, are there folks that we missed totally?
I'm there.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys. Just trying to get to a quiet place. Good evening to all the callers. In the system of white supremacy, I think all police dogs are trained to attack black people. I mean, who else they gonna attack? Who else do they lock up? Yeah, I would think that they probably, like I've seen police at the shooting range with all of the mannequin things that they shoot at and stuff is black, usually a black image of the thing in the target. So I can see that they probably have a black arm that they hold out for the dog to bite, or a Negro scent that they have hoarded all these years, and they put it on that arm. Biting. Not even on the suspect list. He says, Donald Trump is the first racist president. And I said, honestly, wow, you know, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, you know, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, I mean, even Kanye calls him racist. I mean, Richard Nixon. How do you skip all of those presidents? Very, very, very refined. You know, this is the way they're trying to present it. And then these white people, they're so proficient. They want to remove the statues and monuments, rename buildings, change Uncle Ben's and Aunt Jemima, and revise, this is how they revise history. And now they want to take away all the names of the people they conquered from the sports teams. You know, the Redskins, the Indians, the Braves, the Blackhawks, the Eskimos, Aztecs, Seminoles. I remember when they made St. John change their name from Redmond to Red Storm. That was a long time ago. Surprise is just catching up to the Redskins. But they want to keep the names of the people that conquered these people, the Yankees, the Vikings, the Buccaneers, the Raiders, the Hoosiers, Cavaliers, Celtics, Sooners. You go down the list of all the white conquerors' names on the teams. Now, how are they going to take away all the Indian teams and not take away the Cowboys? Even though I understand that, you know, there's a black cowboy history, but just saying usually you see an Indian and the first thing you think is the white cow, John Wayne, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know. So just interesting how they're shenangling all that together. I don't know. I've listened to the clip you played. Things like John Lewis was fighting for gender-confused people or sexually confused people to have civil rights, which is very dangerous, in my opinion. We had civil rights already, and then somehow we were coerced into marching for more civil rights, and white women just seemed to ease their way right into the civil rights legislation. So now, I think this Black Lives Matter, I could be wrong, is leading to a LGBT mention. Now, white women already have white rights, the civil rights, so the only people that's going to gain them is white men who classify themselves as gay. Just very interesting. How are we going to know if that's really a gay person? Or, either way, interesting how they're shenangling, well, maneuvering those things together. The clip from the guy that you played from Brooklyn, the problem here in New York is the police are just not doing their job. They're being defunded by the mayor, and that's why we have this huge spike in crime. Last year, we had, to this date, 362 shooting incidents, and so far this year, we have 636 shooting victims already, just the same date. Police are not doing what they normally do. Chief of police was sucker punched on the bridge. The mayor let the guy who punched him out with a DAT, a death appearance ticket, due to the strict protest pacification policy. So, you know, anything a protester does, they just get, you know, sent home with a ticket. People are literally riding mopeds and electric scooters on the solids, you know, ducking and dodging through strollers and little kids. Someone's going to get killed. Police are not issuing any tickets. And not to mention, they got the city bikes everywhere. They're riding them on the sidewalk as well. It's, you know, just walking down the street is dangerous. People got their beach chairs in front of their houses. They got open liquor bottles. They're smoking their weed. The police are not doing anything. It's like I've never seen anything like it. So something's really going on here. All this freedom, you know, it just seems like it's leading to more crimes. Trump wants to send – now, Gus, I personally think that you guys will be getting more too easy with the feds. I personally want Trump to send the Navy SEALs and Delta Force into Seattle. That has to be broken up. In Portland, they're snatching up protesters and unmarked vans like the A-Team. You know, this is the feds. Now, he's sending the Marshals, the ATF, the FBI, the DEA, and the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security in the Chicago, which is BIE, domestic terrorism, end up on Guantanamo Bay probably, mother never going to see you, daddy, you know. This is something different. 70 people shot last week there, 16 dead, 14 people shot at a funeral. You know, they could just run the numbers to justify this. The sort of picture with the police getting bottles and bricks thrown at them at Grant Park. Like, it's, you know, what can they do? Now, the problem with the feds is they're always in New York. And every now and then you'll have federal bus in the housing projects, 150 people locked up, people with oxygen bags getting put out in handcuffs. You know what I mean? They go get everybody. They form an investigation, and then they have a very small bar that they have to pull. What they have to do is pull Vico or conspiracy. So then they tie everyone in. You were taking a picture with someone. Now, you might have been a member of that group. Now, you're under investigation. You call people. They call it your aunt, your aunt, anyone who dealt with anything that they were doing illegal. So Chicago is about to get hit hard. And it's terrible. The minimum is like 10 years. In the feds, and they got cameras everywhere in Chicago, like New York. Everything that happens gets stored on the cloud. The feds are going to follow cell phone pings to find out who was in areas for shootings that haven't been unsolved and solve all that stuff, because they haven't been solving any shootings in Chicago for the last few years. And that's what I got for now, guys. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. It is so common. I've done this myself, like, repeatedly. I have to, you know, catch myself often. Kanye West didn't say George Bush was racist. He said George Bush doesn't like black people. Just point that out, because that is, say all the time, we shouldn't say that white people are racist. Anywho, Thomas in New York was saying that all police dogs are trained to attack black people. Who else are they going to attack? So that's, you know, Thomason, you are always taking things to the extreme. Every police dog is trained to be a white dog. And I said, oh, wait a minute. The Ferguson Report reading is more important than watching television. So Michael Brown Jr., was that 6 years ago, this summer, after he was killed, they issued a report with, you know, this is all the bad things we found about the Ferguson Police Department and their court system. So if you read the Ferguson, the report that the justice, the feds issued on the Ferguson Police Department on page 8, it says, these disparities are also present in Ferguson Police Department use of force. Nearly 90% of force used by FPD officers was used against African Americans. In every canine bite incident for which racial information is available, the person bitten was African American. Skipping to page 31, FPD engages in a pattern of excessive force in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Many officers are quick to escalate encounters with subjects they perceive to be disobeying their orders or resisting arrest. They have come to rely on escalation tactics, specifically tasers, where less force or no force at all would do. They also release canines on unarmed subjects unreasonably and before attempting to use force less likely to cause injury. They have a whole flipping section on Ferguson Police Department use of canines. Subsection B on page 31. FPD's use of canines on low-level unarmed offenders is unreasonable. FPD engages in a pattern of deploying canines to bite individuals when the articulated facts do not justify this significant use of force. The department's own records demonstrate that, as with other types of force, canine officers use dogs out of proportion to the threat posed by the people they encounter, leaving serious puncture wounds to nonviolent offenders, some of them children. Furthermore, in every canine bite incident for which racial information is available, the subject was African American. This disparity, in combination with the decision to deploy canines in circumstances with a seemingly low objective threat, suggests that race, should be white racism, may play an impermissible role in officers' decisions to deploy canines. FPD currently has 4 canines, each assigned to a particular canine officer. Under FPD policy, canines are to be used to locate and apprehend dangerous offenders, FPD General Order 49800. When offenders are hiding, the policy states handlers will not allow their canine to engage a suspect by biting if a lower level of force could reasonably be expected to control the suspect or allow for the apprehension. The policy also permits the use of force of a canine, however, when any crime, not just a felony or violent crime, has been committed. This permissiveness, combined with the absence of meaningful supervisory review and apparent tendency to overstate the threat based on race, has resulted in avoidable dog bites to low-level offenders where other means of control were available. In December 2011, officers deployed a canine to bite an unarmed 14-year-old African-American boy who was waiting in an abandoned house for his friends. 4 officers, including a canine officer, responded to the house mid-morning after a caller reported that people had gone inside.
officers arrested one boy on the ground level, describing the offense as a burglary in progress, even though the facts showed that the only plausible offense was trespassing. The canine officer's report stated that the dog located a second boy hiding in a storage closet under the stairs in the basement. The officer peeked into the space and saw the boy, who was 5'5 and 140 pounds, curled up in a ball hiding. According to the officer, the boy would not show his hands despite being warned that the officer would use the dog. The officer then deployed the dog, which bit the boy's arm, causing puncture wounds. I will stop there, but it goes on and on about the use of force. And in fact, the reason I hadn't mentioned it until Thomas in New York said that, it was extensive because they said, wow, it seems like using the dogs is a standard tactic when they go after children. I just told you about the dog that bit a 14-year-old. It was not isolated. It seemed like the dog bite incidents they had were all black children.
Hello, Gus. Can I add something really quick?
Let me make sure, because we have, I think, folks who have not shared at all. Let's make sure we nab all of them. Anybody we missed totally, make sure we nab all of that first, all of them first.
Can I bear it?
Henry in Chicago. Uh-oh. Might not hear from him ever again.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Ironic you say that. It kind of is funny, but it's not. But I just wanted to give an update on this Operation Legend, as it is called, of sending federal agents, you know, to different cities, including cities like Chicago. Three people have been arrested, all three of them non-white black men, all charged with possession of illegal firearm. And because of the fact that it is a federal case, they get a minimum sentence of 9 years. Now, here's the thing. None of them have been connected to any murders or have been charged with any murders or shootings that has happened in the last several weeks or years. So just illegal gun possession charges for these three black males. That's all I have on my line.
Stay safe. When they were talking about what it could be like for Chicago, Homeland Security. Remember Irritated Genie? Bringing up old stuff. Talking about what it could be for Chicago. I was like, wow, that just sounds like more of the same. John Birch, that's what they were doing. Remember they would put the electrical prod on the testicles and taking people into detention without charging them and then being held indefinitely. That's just the good old days of the Windy City, like right on. Bring back Mayor Daley. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally? Anybody we missed? People do that. They wait. We are ending in 8 minutes. Any folks that we missed totally?
May I be heard?
For Black Panther. Yes,
greetings
sir.
To God. Oh. Thank you. Greetings to God, all the listeners and callers. I'm calling from the California side of the plantation, specifically the area referred to as Southern California. So the high school that I went to apparently was named after a suspected racist who was affiliated with the eugenics movement. He goes by the name of John Muir. He's often described as the father of the national parks. I was reading an article, and it appears that there is a movement to rename the name of my high school, which is very interesting. Moving forward, I did have commentary with regard to the supposed uprisings or the rioting that's taking place. There was, I guess, what's being referred to or described as the Solidarity March that took place in Oakland earlier today. And there's also what's being described as a solidarity march in downtown LA. So the rioting, well, I'd say they're rioting, but there appears to be some response to the rioting that's taking place in Portland. And lastly, I read an article earlier this week. I guess the Pasadena Tournament of Roses, that the world-renowned Rose Parade, is being canceled. And I know that a lot of suspected race about that. And I guess it's pretty major because it's only happened 3 times ever. So it appears that the Pasadena or the city or the area referred to as Pasadena is not hosting the 2021 Rose Parade. That concludes my commentary. Thank you for letting me share.
I saw that they make a big to-do about spectacles. Mentioned that word before. Spectacles. To have a rose parade. I don't know what the constructive value of that is. But yeah, I think they said World War II. I have to double check on that, but I think that might have been the last time that they canceled the Rose Parade. So, like more than 3/4 of a century. Other folks that we missed totally.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Just really quick, the segment on, I think they were talking about the health status of black people in Alabama, and I thought it was scientific how it looks like they went all the way back to the 1800s to study the whereabouts of the coordinates of where black people resided and the trauma that they faced during what they call slavery, and I guess juxtaposing it to the condition that the area over the area in Alabama where black people are now, it just shows that they do a lot of intense studying. And the next one was the segment where I think it was toward the end of the white terrorism, and that quote where I think that was the female victim just saying that, "I just don't understand," and you can just tell the confusion and the misery that racism has caused the victim. And I have 3 quick reports on this area. It looks like in Baker County, the commission, they did vote to take down the KKK mural, but they have to decide on where they want to relocate it. So that's also an aspect of these monuments and things like that. Like, they don't seem to destroy it. They just want to relocate it. So you're going to preserve it anyway. So I think racism is involved in that. And 2 more. There was an ad of a lady named Kat Kamick. She's running for Congress. I believe she's trying to take Terry Yoho's spot. I believe. I could be incorrect. And the political ads, definitely I can sense the violence. She's posing with a large rifle with a very intense look on her face, like no smiling, like I got my vest on, I'm ready to shoot. And that's promoting her name and her, her message to run for Congress. And my last one is, there's a guy named T.J. Wiggins, okay? Him and 2 other white people have been arrested in Polk County. And the judge, the sheriff there, now he was just saying about how they want people to arm up for protesters. But this guy, white guy, shot and killed 3 other white people. And the reason I'm saying this is that they showed it on local news on Sunday, and it disappeared, okay? And then people started posting that this guy, from the age of 12 to his current age, 26, has accumulated 230 felony charges, 230, and served 2 prison sentences and was still released back into society. and I have seen no more report on it. So definitely white supremacy is real. White power is real. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
I read about Mr. Wiggins. I didn't play any audio connected to that, but I did read about that. It was the triple murder in Florida, and they were stunned, like, ooh, oh my goodness, this was a small area, like, who did this? Why did they do this? Was it Negro? Bill Cosby get loose? And so they get T.J. Wiggins, and these are some scruffy-looking whites to me, it looks like. But they said they think this was over like a truck. Like, he went up to him, was like, oh, you took the engine out of my truck? Unloaded, and the guy came, like, oh man, hey, what are you doing? Stop it. He shot and killed them too. Like, what? Talk about Homeland Security. Like, get Wiggins and his whole clan of. Man. Where do we want to focus it? Do we want to talk about Chicago? We want to talk about race soldiers like this down in the good old Florida. That was where they were bragging in Polk County. Remember? He said, we wish somebody would come out to Polk County and think they're going to Black Lives Matter us and have some rioting, man. You come out here and try. Even the folks at the court, like, that's right. That's right. Polk County, making the jingle about it. Polk County, we love us some Polk. Man, come on. Come on. B in Toronto. Let's see if we can do this in 30 seconds. We can get out of here. Woo! B in Toronto. Thought we were going to get in our update. Perhaps not. Irie in Louisiana, were you going to get to?
Yeah, I saw a couple videos with police dogs. One was a younger black male, hands in the air, next to his girlfriend. I don't know what they wanted him for. But I watched them release the dog, and he had his hands not only in a, you know, position of not having a weapon, but in a position of surrender. And when they, when the officer was, I don't know what he was doing. I honestly believe he was trying to torture the young man because he kept lifting the dog up as the dog was still biting into the gentleman's leg. And there was another video I saw a long time ago. An elderly woman was taking some trash out. I think it was Milwaukee, and the dog was released. They were just following the dog. The dog got a smell, went around, hit the woman who was just taking out the trash, and it took an incredibly long time for them to get the dog off of the woman. So either these people are incompetent in their training and they can't control the animal to release upon command, or, you know, they're just allowing the people to be tortured.
We'll leave it there. Thank you kindly. Okay. Ian Toronto, did you have your 30 seconds? 20. Oh, it looks like a line. Oh, there we go.
Yes, thank you. So, yes, to respond to your earlier inquiry, yes, there has been a cash shortage, not in terms of the coins, but in terms of the $50. But apparently, $50 is being hoarded, so to speak. So it's not being used, but just to, I guess many people have it on cash, or like just as a standby. But looking into the story earlier, so much.
Much obliged. They are they're balling. They're hoarding big bills, and we can't even get quarters here in the U.S. Man, my final comment. I told our caller in Florida. I read about these white savages in Florida who did this triple murder. I think all the people that they killed were white. I think I have to double check. But what I thought was important when I read this. It was titled, I read this from theledger.com, Frostproof Triple Homicide Arrests. This is evil in the flesh. Polk Sheriff Grady Judd says, in the flesh. Evil in the flesh. Somebody asked about that too. Evil. That word. Evil in the flesh. T.J. Wiggins and his white Klan in Polk County. Man, if you go to Florida, be real careful in Polk County. My gosh. White Sav, evil in the flesh, resides in Polk County, Florida. We will call it a broadcast. We'll be here Tuesday for... Dr. Tyler Perry, and it's P-A-R-R-Y, Tyler Perry. He'll be here Tuesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So we'll discuss his report about dogs, hounds being used to patrol and maintain the plantation system, catch Negro runaways. And then he is also writing about White Dog, our current book study read. I hope people remember that. I remember we talked about that with Ferguson. They were sicking dogs on black children specifically. I think some of the news outlets, when they read this, were like, wow, they're not just like taxing black people, like they're sicking dogs on black people exclusively in Ferguson. Like, wow, what is... Anyway, it has been a broadcast. Stay safe. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You got white dogs, you got armed white people, you got the Rona. We need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency. In addition to being sober, repeat everything I just said. Rona, armed white people, evil in the flesh in Polk County. A lot of reasons to stay in the house right now. If you gotta go out, and I'm sure, you know, got things to do, I would be real vigilant, paying attention to what's happening around you, avoiding skirmishes, not arguing with anybody about anything. No arguments, nothing, go get security or what have you, or it's time to go, but there are going to be no kerfuffles out in public. Assume if it's a white person, they are probably armed, and they may have come out of the house with the intent of harming a black person. Any black person will do, including you. You are hyper-vigilant. When out of the house, tell your offspring, if you have them, that pay attention. Very dangerous times on the plantation. People being snatched up and put in vehicles. Man, lots of reasons to stay in the house, being truthful. If you gotta go out, you are sober. You are buckled, driver or passenger. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Reason number one, we got to be paying attention. Don't have resources to waste talking to somebody that we can chat it up with once we get to a parked location. Secondly, we need to be minimizing contact with race soldiers, badge or no, in any way we can. Staying off the cell phone, buckled up while we're driving. Little things can help. Again, we have one slot for the retreat. Drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you would like to hang in D.C. safely and do yoga, vegan meals, August 5 through the 9th. Creator, help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask you to help us remain patient with ourselves. No name calling. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.